Choose your next words carefully, Leonidas. They may be your last.
Madman. You're a madman. Blasphemy. This is madness.
This is Sparta!
Who do we have left? Britney Spears? Cam Kardashian? Paris Hilton? Yeah, that's what we have to look forward to, Kanye West. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good evening. We're global.
I mean, the lines are blowing up.
Shop, S-H-O-P-P-E. Oh, look at you. All right, everybody, I'll be right with you. I'm a good guy. If you attack us, I attack you. Here, hello, my name is Brian Hammer Jackson, and you're with the Brian Hammer Jackson Show. Boy, it was powerful. This is a no-win situation. I'll give you a call in about an hour and a half. I survived it, and I'm at the end of it.
Oppressors of generations who have kept you down with myths
there we
of
go.
Opportunity, and we give it back to you.
Why, are we delayed or what?
The people.
Brother, it is time for the mortals to pay.
Release the Kraken!
Welcome to the show. Right now, we're having technical difficulties. I think it's Blog Talk. I think it's the holidays. Maybe so many people are signing on. I have no idea. What I'm going to do right now, I am Brian Hammer Jackson. What I'm going to do right now is check to see if we are live. If we're live, we'll continue the show. If we're not live, I wish you a happy holiday. Okay. Because right now it says that the site is going on under some maintenance problems. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to switch subjects right now. And I wasn't going to talk about politics or Donald Trump until I see if we're live and find out if there are other people having technical difficulties. So let me go in the studio. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go with the news right now and find out what's going on here with Blog Talk Radio. So hang in there. Should we go with the news or should we just go with Donald Trump? Let's go right now. It's part of the news anyway. Let's go right now to why Republicans are running away from Donald Trump. And here's William Barr. Then I can fix what's going on here with Blog Talk. So listen to William Barr, why people are leaving Donald Trump, and I'll be right back.
Attorney General who resigned and broke with President Trump this week on Firing Line.
Bill Barr can go down as the greatest attorney general in the history of our country, or he can go down as just another guy.
One damn thing after another is the title of William Barr's memoir and a fitting description of his time as Trump's attorney general. Barr was firmly in Trump's camp when it came to denouncing the Russia probe.
I think that the government did not have a prosecutable case.
And warning about the possibility of voter fraud before the 2020 election.
Elections that have been held with mail have found substantial fraud and coercion.
But after Trump lost, they had a stunning break.
I made it clear I did not agree with the idea of saying the election was stolen.
As the former president launches a new White House bid, and prosecutors build cases against Trump and his businesses, what does former Attorney General William Barr say now?
Firing Line with Margaret Hoover is made possible in part by Robert Granieri, Charles R. Schwab, the Fairweather Foundation, the Asness Family Foundation, and by the Rosalind P. Walter Foundation, Damon Button, the Pritzker Military Foundation on behalf of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and the Mark Haas Foundation. Corporate funding is provided by Stevens, Inc.
Attorney General William Barr, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you, Margaret. Great to be here.
You were the Attorney General for two presidents in two different centuries, President George H.W. Bush and President Donald Trump. You resigned after the 2020 election when you broke from President Trump over his 2020 election fraud claims. This week, Donald Trump announced that he will seek the Republican nomination again to be president. And I wonder, what was your reaction?
Well, I made it clear in my book over a year ago that I didn't think he was the right person to lead either the Republican Party or the country forward, and I would hope that he stepped down, so I was disappointed that he announced.
He's facing unprecedented federal, state, and congressional investigations. Do you think he's running to insulate himself from the investigations?
I think that could be part of the reason, but I think he has a monumental ego, and he doesn't want to go down in history as a loser, and he's also would like to get revenge on the people that he feels didn't give him his due.
You said he doesn't want to be seen as a loser, but the 2022 midterm elections had him on the ballot in absentia in many, many cases, and another big loser of the midterms was this lie about the Stop the Steal. And in the case where Stop the Steal candidates were on the ballot, they overwhelmingly lost.
Right.
His handpicked candidates overwhelmingly lost. How do you reflect on the midterms and the fact that the election fraud that you resigned over became a losing political point for the GOP?
Well, again, it reflects Trump's poor judgment and his ego. Look at Ronald Reagan in 1976, okay? He spent 4 years building the unity of the Republican Party. He even discouraged his conservative supporters who had backed him, many of them from challenging some of the so-called establishment Republicans, because he wanted to unify the party. And Trump has done just the opposite, for no purpose other than his ego gratification. And he picked candidates that were weak candidates simply because they were willing to show their fealty to him by saying that the election was stolen. And that backfired completely.
You're clear in your book that GOP needs to move on from Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Does it concern you there could be a splintered field and that Trump could come away with the plurality, the largest share of the primary base vote?
Right. I don't think the field is going to be as splintered as it was in 2016, which obviously helped Trump. I also don't think Trump will be as strong. I think he has been fading for months now, and the recent midterm elections, I think, have really popped his balloon.
If you were in Trump's ear now and he were listening to you, big hypothetical, what would you tell him?
I would tell him essentially what I told him all the way through the administration, which is that if he had exerted some self-control and discipline and dialed back his pugnacity and his nastiness a little bit, he would have won the presidency and had a second term. And he didn't do that. He failed. He didn't do what the whole country hoped, which that he would rise to the occasion and rise to the office, and he didn't do that. So he's had his chance. He obviously does not have the qualities necessary to unite the party, which is the first step on the road back, and he should stand aside.
The two presidents you served approached DOJ differently, and they approached you as Attorney General differently from the position of the White House. Can you describe that?
Well, first, after Watergate, Republicans generally took the position that the Department of Justice should not be tampered with, and that was Bush's philosophy. He followed my advice. He didn't, try to cut corners or get around the advice, and he was very respectful of the role played by the Department of Justice. Obviously, Trump was a different animal.
Would you say Trump was as respectful of the department as President H.W. Bush was?
No, I think he viewed it as a as you know, like any agency, something that was under his command and could, you know, he could sort of potentially use as a political tool.
You write in your memoir, quote, that it is the responsibility of the Attorney General to ensure that the department's enforcement actions are insulated from political interference and are based solely on the law, the facts, and the equal treatment of all individuals without regard to political or personal considerations, and that Trump agreed not to interfere with your decisions.
That's right.
How'd that go?
Well, he didn't interfere with him in the sense of telling me, you know.
Directly.
Directly, but what you know, he would tweet.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, he would tweet that he wanted Comey indicted, or he wanted McCabe indicted, and
James Clapper, John Brennan.
When we got into 2020, you know, he started tweeting that, you know, I hope Bill Barr, you know, has the guts to indict or, you know, go after Biden and Obama.
Is there any difference between him pressuring you privately or doing it publicly?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know which is worse.
Well, that's why I said, you know, his behavior was different, and that's why I asked him to stop tweeting. And for a couple of – he took a few parting shots to show who was in charge, and then he quieted down for a couple of months. But in May, he just went –
lit back up again.
Yeah, boom.
You've noted George H.W. Bush, when he was president and you were attorney general, you only met with him a couple times.
A few times.
On the flip side.
I mean, no, one-on-one.
One-on-one,
yeah.
Right? So, but on the flip side with Trump, you characterize that, you know, you often spoke multiple times a day. Was that because the presidents had different views of the Justice Department, as you outlined earlier?
Well, it wasn't just the Department of Justice. It was his way of managing the executive branch and his way... Really, even before he became president, he'd reach out and talk to a lot of people and sort of take all the information in and test his own positions and ideas with other people. And so the whole running of the administration had this sort of free – I compared it to a card game in my fraternity when I was in college, which is somehow the card game kept on going, but the cast of characters changed almost imperceptibly, and you can never tell when something started and when something began. And that's how the Oval Office was, you know, people coming in and, hey, come on – Bill, come on in. Some meeting on trade. I was called into some meeting on trade. I didn't know anything about the topic. What do you think about that? I mean, that's the way he is. Now, there's a good side to that. You know, it allows for internal debate. It allows the cabinet secretary to have his day in court with the president. And, you know, it adds a certain dynamism, you know. But it also ignores process.
And the processes are there for a reason.
Yeah, the processes are there for a reason. Sometimes I took advantage of the free flow of things to advance what I thought was the right thing to do, and other cabinets sometimes kneecapped me, you know, because they were advancing what they wanted
chaos
to do.
Benefits
so
everyone. Yeah.
Chaos
yeah.
might be – there was chaos.
In 1987, Firing Line hosted a debate with the Republican presidential candidates, and your former boss, George H.W. Bush – was one of the participants, and he was asked why Republicans were running on a platform that government, to paraphrase Ronald Reagan, was the problem, not the solution. Take a look at his answer.
I'm not anti-government. When I was at the CIA, I ran into some of the finest, most public-spirited people I've ever served with. And so I'm not one who tears down those who have elected to serve their country. But really, I think what it boils down to is leadership. Leadership in the White House and leadership in the United States Congress. Don't blame those that make a lifetime of service to the government. Give them the kind of leadership they need, and they'll follow and get the job done.
You worked under George H.W. Bush when he was CIA director as well, when you were still at the CIA. And you write in your book, quote, he was easily accessible and he trusted CIA professionals. Unless they gave him reason not to. I learned a lot watching him lift up a dispirited organization. Talk more about what you learned from Bush's leadership.
Well, exactly that. He was CIA director for 1 year.
Yeah.
And that institution is now named after him. When you drive by it in Langley, it's the George H.W. Bush Center. And he was highly regarded because... he basically trusted people in the agency. He didn't separate himself from them and, you know, bash them and so forth. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say that it was a different age.
Mm-hmm.
Things have, you know, evolved. So, you know, I wouldn't take what he said to say to say, well, gee, you know, the people who are saying there's a deep state today are, you know, wrong, right? There is a deep state.
That's where that's where I'm going. So, given that you've worked with career professionals, you have had a long career of interfacing with civil servants who have made their life in the government. I think you're actually particularly well suited to comment about the state of the deep state, whether it exists, how it exists, what it looks like, to put some nuance and some texture around it for me.
Well, I think the people who attack the deep state, and I am critical of the deep state and believe it exists, but there's also some of the rhetoric and some of the positioning.
So how do you define it?
The way I would define the deep state is an increased willingness by more and more government civil servants to pursue political objectives rather than stand up for the values of the institution they're a part of. They are not neutral. They're not politically neutral. But on the other side of the ledger, okay, is that I think there's an exaggeration of its pervasiveness. It's bad.
Uh-huh.
It does pervert government. But I still think the vast majority of civil servants try to do an honest job and try to check their politics at the door. And I think that that President Bush's quote that you played mm-hmm. is right on the money. The most important thing is leadership. Mm-hmm. When you provide clear guidance and goals, people will, the institution will deliver for you. You can move the institution. And I think people who come in to run the government and to try to govern, who treat government employees as pariahs, are not doing their job, right?
Let me ask you about something you referred to earlier. You talked about, you were referring to President Trump's tweeting and sort of open, I mean, I would call it sort of open bullying about what the Department of Justice should be doing. Trump publicly expressed disapproval for how justice handled Michael Flynn and Roger Stone. And under your tenure, the Department of Justice dropped the prosecution against General Flynn, and then in the case of Stone, overruled prosecutors by lowering the recommended sentencing of prison time. What do you say to the critics who point that DOJ charged approximately 80,000 cases in your tenure per year, and that only two got set aside that happened to be the ones that President Trump was most audible on?
In the Department of Justice, tough decisions are elevated, or where there's a disagreement over a decision, it's elevated, and eventually it finds its way to the Attorney General, who has to make a decision. And in both of those cases, there were events that brought those matters to my desk. And as I explain in my book, and I go through all the details of both episodes, what I tried to do in every case was do what I thought was right under our standards of the Department of Justice and even-handed justice. And I couldn't allow the fact that the president was tweeting about stuff prevent me from doing that.
So knowing that the optics risked looking as though it was political, you went ahead
That's the Attorney General's job.
Yeah.
If the Attorney General starts saying, you know, how is this going to, you know, am I going to be attacked if I do this? And then doesn't do what he thinks is right, that's not the kind of Attorney General you want. You want an Attorney General who will try to do the right thing regardless of the cost to themselves.
How important is character
in a
president from your position as having been Attorney General twice?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's extremely important. The character is very important. But when we live in an age where the political differences are so polarized, and the swings between sort of almost socialism and more conservative Republican policies, and there's a broad swing, I think you have to look at that just as importantly. So, for example, a progressive Democrat as an individual might have a lot of character, more than the Republican candidate. I would not cast my vote just based on their character. I would look at the impact on the United States and what it means for the country.
But character is more important than ideology? Or as important as ideology.
As important. Nowadays, yes.
Really?
Well, think about it. You know, we're facing a very dangerous world right now. I think as a voter, you should say, what, you know, is the impact on the country of this person leading the country for the next 4 years? Some of our great presidents have not been moral exemplars.
No, I think the question of character is important, but then it's also a question of, in that character, are you going to be faithful to the laws and the Constitution?
Well, I mean, when we talk about character, I was thinking broadly of it. Obviously,
yeah.
It's very important that a president, you know, the president is in charge of the executive branch, and he is the top law enforcement official.
Mm-hmm.
But what's critical for our country and for our system of government is that the law be applied equally, you know, especially in the criminal justice system.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the president has to respect that,
yeah.
That you cannot use the criminal justice system as a political weapon.
You broke with Trump over the election, as we've discussed. You broke with him over election fraud. In the lead-up to the election, you had been pointing to election fraud as a potential problem. And looking back on it and how it turned out, where there were so many Americans that believed Donald Trump and believed his election fraud lies, even after the Attorney General said there wasn't enough election fraud to have changed the outcome of the election. Do you think back at the times where you were raising the red flag prior to that and consider whether that helped lay the ground for people to distrust the integrity of the elections in the first place?
See, on the contrary, I think what did was the irresponsible behavior of the Democrats who, putting aside the question of fraud, were clearly monkeying with the rules and using COVID as an excuse to do it, to tilt the playing field in ways that were unfair to the Republicans or which favored them. And people saw that kind of gamesmanship going on, and that created the climate in which they did not have trust in the election. You have, you know, people know what the mail system is in this country. People have had experience with it, and they don't trust, didn't trust the integrity of the system.
Well, to the contrary, there are 4 states that had 100% mail-in voting. I'm from one of them, Colorado.
Right.
People have a really high degree of faith in the election integrity in those states.
Well, it depends on what kind of system you have. If you have a system where you fill out applications and to get the ballot to mail in, that is a pretty good security system. And the states that have done that are not a problem. And I said that publicly, okay? What I objected to was universal mailing out of ballots. I was arguing against what I considered to be the irresponsible, really incendiary tactics of the Democrats, which is to essentially try to run elections on an honor system. And I'm saying, you do that, and no one's going to trust the results. Period. And to raise that red flag was the right thing to do, to try to stop that kind of irresponsible behavior.
You left the Trump White House in mid-December, just after the Electoral College had voted, and you wrote in your book, quote, without minimizing both the stupidity and shamefulness of what happened, you're referring to January 6th, at the time, I did not think the Republic was in genuine danger.
You know, I don't really think so. I think it's a little overdramatic. I didn't see it as something that was threatening a coup at the time. It was the way things operate when Trump is directly in charge of something and there are not people who know what they're doing involved.
Well,
it was a mess. It was a Keystone Cop ops operation.
Well, now I'm thinking about the riot at the Capitol, though, and the fact that violence actually impeded the peaceful transition of power for a time.
Well, I mean, there was a delay.
Yeah.
But I didn't think, you know, that you know, our country was going to fall apart because of that.
Or that the Republic was
or that, you know, there was going to be a coup. And I've said, look, if there's evidence that people in the government, the White House, the president, whatever, were part of a scheme to use violence to delay the count, that would be a crime. And people should go to jail for that if it can be proved. I haven't seen the evidence yet. There may have been some of the demonstrators who had that plan, And they have been indicted for that.
But it was more than chaos. I mean, six people died. And there's a real question about had any member of Congress or Mike Pence come across any of those rioters, whether they also might have been violently attacked.
Yeah. I feel it is an exaggeration, a little bit of melodrama to treat this as the virtual or, you know, almost the collapse of the American government or the overthrow of the government. I thought it was a stupid, reckless behavior by the people involved. Certainly the president, I think, precipitated it, whether he legally incited or not, he precipitated the whole thing. And, you know, I let it be known what my views were.
Yeah. In September, you said the Justice Department was getting close. You said, quote, getting close to having enough evidence to indict Trump in the classified documents investigation. But you also said you hope they don't indict him. In your view, is there ever a circumstance where you think is appropriate to indict a former president?
Oh, yes. You know, if a former president commits a crime, you know, especially a serious crime, they should be indicted for it. If the Department of Justice can show that these were indeed very sensitive documents, which I think they probably were, and also show that the president consciously was involved in misleading the department, deceiving the government, and playing games after he had received the subpoena for the documents, those are serious charges.
That's a serious crime.
Well, I personally think that they probably have the basis for legitimately indicting the president. I don't know. I'm speculating.
You're speculating, yeah.
But given what's gone on, I think they probably have the evidence that would check the box. They have the case.
And if they have it, should they?
That's a decision for...
If you were AG, would you?
I'm not going to get into that.
Do you think they will?
I think it's becoming increasingly more likely.
And you think it would be appropriate if they did?
Well, this is what the Attorney General gets paid, these kinds of decisions. You know, the argument for doing it is that if you let someone like this who, you know, if the facts are as raw as they may be, and you let someone get away with it, how can you protect these secrets? How can you insist on people in government taking this stuff seriously? So, you know, that's an important thing to weigh, as well as what the, you know, what it will do to the country and to the office of the presidency. And I think Merrick Garland is going to have to make that call.
If Donald Trump were the nominee for the Republican Party again, would you support him?
Well, I'm just hoping it never comes to that, because I think it would be a tragedy if he's our nominee, if he's the Republican nominee.
Could you vote against him? Could you vote not for the Republican if Donald Trump were the Republican nominee?
Well, again, I think it gets down to what I said, which is I would have to make the judgment at that point the impact on the country, and I'll have to see what's going on in the world, who the Democratic nominee is. If it's a progressive Democratic nominee, I can't imagine voting for
it. But ideologically progressive versus somebody who orchestrated an attack on the Capitol, whom betrayed his oath to the Constitution, as you said in your words, you still might vote for him.
Mm-hmm. Depending on all this, it's hard for me to project what the future holds. The question is always a comparative one. You have to make a choice between two people. I don't believe in throwing my vote away on a third party.
You don't rule out supporting President Trump again?
No, I don't. Depends on the circumstances. I pray that that doesn't come. I think the reason our republic is in jeopardy is because we are not throwing up the best and the brightest for these offices. We're not giving the American people good choices. Too frequently, they're picking the lesser of two evils. And we can't last very long if that continues to happen.
Attorney General William Barr, thank you for joining me on Firing Line.
Okay. Thanks.
Firing Line with Margaret Hoover is made possible in part by Robert Grenier, Charles R. Schwab.
Well, folks, I can't get into the studio. Blog Talk won't let me access the studio. So that's it. Until I get these technical difficulties over, I really can't get in. I can't talk to you. I'm not in the studio. I could try one more thing, but I don't think it's going to work. And Blog Talk has been notified, but it usually takes a day or two before they get back to me. So I'm blind here. I can't see if there's anybody in the studio. I can't access the studio. I can go on and on with more, unless there's one person I know that's listening, that she can tell me if she's hearing it. I can try one more thing. I can stall one more time and see if I can get it. You know, we're going to talk about anxiety, depression for the holidays. That's what we're going to talk about. And that people are going through, and that's real. And the reason we're talking about that, I don't know if I'm live. I think I have to be. Is that a friend of mine is having problems dating. There's a death going on in a family, and she was married for a while, and she tried to get into a dating situation. She's over, and it's really hard for women over 40 to really date. Technically, if you're over 40, if you're a woman, again, I can't get in the studio. The dating life is hard. It's not being cruel. It's not being mean. It's what's out there. It's out there. The stragglers, the whatever. It's not I'm dating you for you. It's an agenda, what you could provide for me. My voice is kind of raw because I've been working all night. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this, and I will contact the person I think is listening. If it's still listening live, I will still try to work to get in the studio. Death is part of the holidays. You know, we're talking about depression. And it may be the first year that you're without someone at the table because they died this year. Divorce, breakup. Death is a mystery. This guy, Dr. Christopher Kerr, he's very interesting. He is very, very interesting. And he says, I see dead people. I would love for people to listen to this guy, especially if you're having a hard time with the holidays and depression. And I will contact my person to see if they're still listening to the show, if I'm still alive. If not, I'll go down and bye-bye. But until then, listen to Dr. Christopher Kerr. And again, he's talking about dreams and visions of dying. And it could be uplifting. Just give it a minute. Here we go. And I'll continue to work on getting into the studio.
So I read a recent survey, and the title was, What Americans Fear Most? Public Speaking and Dying. In other words, my TED Talk. If that weren't tough enough, tonight's topic is illumination. And the question is really, can dying be illuminated? What we know of dying is based on what we have observed as witnesses. We have all seen grim physical decline and suffering, and we've all felt profound loss. So if there's light within the darkness of dying, it's in the experience, not in the observing. So tonight I'm going to share with you the words and experience of dying patients. And my hope is that you hear what I have heard, the dying often describing their end of life in ways that are actually life-affirming and rich with meaning, love, and even grace. Before I go any further, I need to give a few disclaimers. If it looks like I can't stand still and pacing, it's because it's true. The second is that aside from my mother, nobody has ever described me as particularly spiritual or, for that matter, enlightened. And trust me, this talk has nothing to do with the paranormal. A much harder truth for me is that I have a deep aversion to the non-physical, spiritual aspects of dying that goes back to my childhood. On August 6, 1974, I was 12 years old, and I was standing over the bed of my dying father, who was 42. As he lying there, he reached out and he started playing with my buttons on my shirt, and he said we had to hurry, we had to catch a plane. We were going to go up north and fish like we had before, and that was the last time I saw him. My point here is I didn't choose this topic of dying. I feel it has chosen or followed me throughout my life, personally and professionally. Like my father, I became a doctor. This may sound strange, but if you have an aversion to dying, medical school is a pretty safe place to be. They never mention dying, let alone the experiencing of it. Medical training is learning how to defy death. And when you can't defy it, you deny it in whole or in part. This approach to medicine worked for me when I was doing things like working in emergency rooms. But in 1999, through a series of unusual events, I ended up at this place called hospice. At hospice, the curative science has not only failed the patient, but it abandons the doctor, who is eventually compelled to be present. And when I was present at the bedside of the dying, I was confronted by what I had seen and tried so hard to forget from my childhood. I saw dying patients reaching and calling out to mothers and to fathers and to children, many of whom hadn't been seen for many years. But what was remarkable was so many of them looked at peace. In April of 1999, I was in the room of a patient I was particularly fond of. Her name was Mary. She was nearing the end of her life, and her four children were also present. One day, Mary starts cradling a baby that nobody can see. She refers to him as Danny, a reference nobody understands. The next day, Mary's sister arrives from out of town and explains that Danny was actually Mary's first child, who was stillborn. The loss was so deep that Mary was unable to speak of it during her life. Yet while dying, this indescribable loss returns to her in some manner of tangible warmth and tangible love. Mary, like so many dying patients, had physical wounds that could not be cured, yet her spiritual wounds were tended to. A few weeks later, I went and saw a young man named Tom. I came out of the nurse's station, and I said, you know, I think Tom has more time if we just gave him some IV antibiotics and some IV fluid. And without so much as looking up, a nurse named Nancy says, nope, he's dying. I say, why? She says, because he's seen his deceased mother. I say, I don't remember that class from medical school. She says, son, you missed a lot of classes. Anyways, so Tom ends up dying. What Nancy knew that I did not know was that Tom's end-of-life experiences had meaning. They were significant, and not just to him, but to those of us entrusted in his care. So if I was to have any worth, I needed to understand, I needed to learn. I learned that end-of-life experiences are the subjective experiences of the dying, and often refer to pre-death dreams and visions. Such experiences have been reported throughout history and across cultures. They're mentioned in the Bible, Plato's Republic, Shakespeare. In our culture, the richest and most thoughtful discussions have always come from the humanities and never medicine, but from poets and playwrights and philosophers. These observers have commented that end-of-life experiences are so frequent they're essentially intrinsic to the process of dying. They're characterized as real, intense, meaningful, provide comfort, insight, and in so doing, help alleviate the fear of dying. So why does medicine have so little to say about something that's so meaningful and actually potentially therapeutic, not just for the patient, but for the patient's loved ones? In part, it's because end-of-life experiences can easily be dismissed as confusion. And it's true. Many dying patients experience confusion as they go through the process. However, in contrast to patients' experience with end-of-life dreams and visions, confused patients are detached. They have disorganized thinking. They're unable to figure out their surroundings, and they're more often than not terribly agitated and anxious. The distinction is best seen by listening to a patient. The patient you're about to see, her name is Jeannie, and she, in this video, she was nearing the end of her life, and she has since passed.
I was laying in bed, and people were walking very slowly by me. The right-hand side, I didn't know, but they were all very friendly, and they touched my arm or my hand when they went by. And But the other side were people that I knew. My mom and dad were there. My uncle. Everybody I knew that was dead was there. And they passed and did the same thing. I thought it was a good dream, but boy, I remember seeing every...
So again, the question, why are the words of the dying not more worthy of our consideration? I don't have all of the answer, but it's true we live in a time where seeing is believing, and data and evidence are requisites for both understanding and acceptance. Unfortunately, when it comes to end-of-life experiences, most of the reports were based on anecdotal reporting. In other words, nobody had asked patients directly or measure. So that's what we've done, and to date, we have over 1,400 interviews with dying patients. In our first study, we spoke with 66 patients every day until their death and gathered 450 interviews. What we found is the vast majority, over 80%, reported at least one pre-death dream and vision, described as more real than real and distinct from normal dreaming. The next question is, what were they dreaming of? What we found out was 72% dreamed of the deceased, family, relatives, pets. 59 of this theme to go or preparing to go, 29% of the living, and 28% past meaningful experiences. So the next question was this. Did different dream content provide different levels of comfort? And here's comfort on a 0 to 5 scale, with 5 being the highest. And of all the dream types, seeing the deceased was associated with the greatest degree of comfort. The next question was, were there changes over time in either the content or frequency of dreaming as patients approached death? Essentially the Nancy question. Could you almost predict death based on changes of these variables? And of course, again, Nancy's right. Frequency is on the y-axis, weeks before death on the x. And as patients approach death, they have a dramatic increase in the frequency of their dreaming, but dreaming specifically of the deceased, which is associated with the greatest comfort. So the next question we wanted to ask in our next study was, what did these mean to the dreamer? Were there common themes? Were there
Okay, thank you. Now I'm in a studio. We're having trouble, but I think you can hear me. What was very interesting about that, and I heard it when you guys heard it. I didn't hear it before. We both played this first time I heard it. What was interesting is that 6 years ago, I did a private call. And I talked to different people regarding death, near death. We had a woman in there. We did a show long ago where a woman was clinically dead. She came back alive. We asked her, what did she see? She couldn't really tell us. The thing is that it was almost like a parallel universe. Hey, I think it's working. Stanley? I think the studio screwed up. You got in. How you doing, buddy?
Yeah. Good morning. What's up with you? What do you mean the studio screwed up?
Yeah. I couldn't get in the studio. It was locking me out. I just finally got in. So
It's because the FBI and the CIA is listening to you, and they're saying, no, don't let him go in. We don't want Brian to have his access to tell the truth to the people.
Is that what it
block
is?
Block him. Block him. You don't want him to know the truth. No, block him.
You may be right.
To people. Too much information. No, we don't want that. We want people, we want us Americans to be stupid and just listen with feelings.
Well, you know what? Let me, I was torn between this morning. This morning, I mean, this is my, I mean, still kind of holidays. People are traveling.
Are you going to play the meltdown of the leftists because Trump got accepted in Twitter? He's back. And they're freaking out like it's the end of the world. Oh, my God. Trump is back in Twitter. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I don't pay attention to those people. You know, I went down that wormhole for 3 years.
Hello.
Stanley?
Yeah, I'm here. It's go ahead.
What happened? Can you hear me?
I don't know. Yeah, I hear you. It cut, but go ahead.
Yeah, something's happening with Blog Talk. They're under maintenance, and I'm trying to do a show through it.
Oh boy. Jesus Christ.
Under maintenance.
Yeah, they're freaking out because Trump is part of Twitter, like he's going to do World War III, like he's going to do something. Freaking out, like what did Trump do? Come on.
Well, again, I don't know if you can hear me, but I'll say it. I don't know if you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh. I don't pay attention. The people who are freaking out are losers, trolls. They want to be offensive, say something so somebody will. They're like children. Please like me. I'll say something against Trump, and then I'll get more likes, and I'll say something against Trump, and I'll get more likes. I mean, they're children. Oh.
Yeah, but
there
Brian,
she is.
It's the media.
I'm not talking about.
Oh, it worked.
She's my angel, Nightingale. Wait, hold on, Stanley. I got Melissa here. Melissa was seeing me through this trouble. She's like my angel of
hey,
Nightingale.
Beautiful.
It worked.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hey.
Did you have problems, Melissa, in the beginning to try to come in?
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay.
I couldn't even access the site. The site was down.
Yeah. I try my best. I put my ugly picture in there so people can come in. Well, thank you, Melissa, for saying, it's an ugly
picture. That's a good picture. You've had that out for a few days. That's a good picture.
Is it a good picture?
Okay. Very, yeah. All right,
thank you, sweetie.
Stanley, do you like it?
Stanley, what do you think of my picture that's there? Stanley should see it. I didn't use
it. Yeah, it's a good picture. I told you the reason that you couldn't be – I told you, beautiful, the reason he couldn't be in the show is because the FBI, the CIA doesn't want him to tell the truth to the American people. That's why.
Oh, my God. That's what right, Stanley.
They want him to know the truth?
You could be right.
Brian, the Hatter Jackson is telling the truth to the people. No. Shut him down. We don't want that.
Not half wrong. I'm sure Blog Talk, at first I really thought, because I was texting Melissa through the whole thing. And Melissa was my ears, and she was my eyes, and I just hung in there. She's going, I can hear you, I can't, you know. So thank you, Melissa, for walking me through
it.
Welcome. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
What happened?
Now he's gone. Okay. I hear you, but he must have got knocked out of the studio.
He got knocked out? Jeez.
Again?
You're
back. There you are.
What's going on? I can't do a show like this. Wow.
Yeah, you can. Just push on. Persevere.
Well, you guys can't hear
forward
me.
Forward onward.
All right, wait. You guys talk. I'm going to sign out. Come back. Oh, shit. I'm out of the studio. I can't get in. It's under maintenance
again.
I mean, you
can't get in. Yeah,
I can't get in.
You.
It says file or directory is not fine. Okay, I got to log out.
Well, we're here.
We're here, Brian. We hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to try to persevere. With this. This is
just
such bullshit. Over, it's frustrating because I don't know how much time I have left and all that kind of stuff, too. Oh, I'm back in. I'm back in the studio.
Okay.
Can you
hear me? Right. Bring the truth to the American people.
Yes.
What truth are you looking for?
Bring it.
Bring it.
Well, hey, every truth that you have, everything that you have to from
okay,
what
right.
the hell the
Here's
World it. Cup is starting in Qatar and from everything, whatever you want.
All right, I predict that the American soccer team is going to lose in its third round.
Oh.
I do.
Yeah, they're
I think Wales are
going to
be
1/3. They're playing
yeah,
at 1:30
I believe
today.
I predict the score will be 5-2 Wales.
We're playing against who? Yeah, you're playing against Wales. United States
yes.
versus Wales.
Oh
yes.
wow!
Okay. And I think the score will be 5-2 Wales.
Mm.
Isn't Qatar a place where human rights is not done properly or something?
Well, when you're dealing with the Middle East, there's no such thing as human rights. It's
exactly.
male rights and no rights at all. So, even saying
this big fat YouTuber, her name is Foodie Booty. She's really fat, and she's huge. And she just went to oh my god, where's the horrible place in the Middle East where they fight all the time?
Iran.
Oh
Iraq.
My God! Is it
Iran?
Gaza? No, the other one.
Palestine. Gaza.
Brian, you had a friend that was a reporter, and that's where she was.
In Israel.
Okay. This
she was
is,
a reporter.
She went there. She bought a house.
Okay. Is that where we just left? Anyway, it's Middle East.
She bought a husband.
She what?
In their chronicle, she bought this YouTuber bought a husband.
She bought a husband?
Yes. Yeah. And
you
can
buy a husband? Can you buy a wife?
She did. She went over there. Where the heck? Not Lebanon. Where did your friend, where there was always war-torn and...
What was Israel?
Oh, my God.
Help me out. Israel's always fighting with.
I want to see
Gaza.
Wait a minute. Let me see.
Yeah.
Let me see you guys. I
okay, Gaza.
Did it. Wait a minute. It was crazy, and she. It was like, are you kidding me? The women are doing it too.
Good. It's about time. It's cheap labor. It's cheap labor.
You got to see the size of her, man. Yeah.
How much would you say she weighs?
Well, she's short. And I'm going to say well over 400, and she's very proud of it.
400 pounds? That's crazy.
Well over, Stanley. Well over.
Yeah, she's going to have to buy that.
Yeah, if you guys want to watch a saga, because she's really crazy too, watch Foodie Beauty. Mm-hmm. It's really gross. Mm-hmm. Yep. His name is Salah. Crazy. But she bought a husband, and she went over there. I gave her credit for even going there, right?
Yeah, but I want to give credit to a good woman, too. I'm up here trying to do this
Sorry,
studio.
Was, Syria.
Syria. Oh, okay. Oh, Lebanon,
I mean,
Syria?
Yeah.
Lebanon.
What a great place, huh?
So I want to give thanks to two great women. Melissa brought me through this with the technical difficulties. Uh-huh. And meanwhile, I usually don't go on the air without my hot chocolate. Cindy went in there, made my hot chocolate, warmed it up for me, put it right next to me, and patted me on the head like I was a good puppy.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
You're a good guy. There you go.
Yeah.
How to treat women, and they'll bring you hot chocolate.
Uh-huh. That's true. And if you're mean to them, they'll dump it over your head.
Or they spit
right?
in it. Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't do that. Somebody, that's disgusting.
But, you know,
I interrupted you guys. Go back to this, what Stanley was talking about, the government.
No.
And
No, I wasn't talking about it. I'm just saying that people are freaking out because the ex-president is in Twitter and they're acting like the World War III. I'm like, what the hell are you freaking out for?
I thought he denied it. Did I hear he denied it?
Well, no, he said that he hasn't made up his mind yet to come back.
Okay. Okay.
No. Elon Musk, his account is unblocked. He went back to 87 million people are following him now. It was like 50,000. He went back to 87 million. He went back to what he was.
Is he on Twitter now?
Yes.
Oh, he did? Okay.
Yes. Okay. His account is not suspended anymore. He's part of Twitter now.
You know, I don't use it anymore. And do you use it, you guys?
I should. Oh man, I use it for business purposes, but I should be more socialize on it. I should be like a.
I don't want to socialize on there.
I do it for business. I do it for business.
I was using it for news, and it was good for news.
You?
Yeah. But I don't know. I deleted the app from my phone. I still have the account, but I deleted the app. It's just that I don't know. I get stuff, and I'm like, why is this here? But, yeah.
Well,
I don't know.
You
can live on there, too. Did you know that?
Yeah, you can go live there.
What do they call it? Stories?
I'm sorry?
What do they call it? Stories?
I don't know. I haven't investigated Twitter's live feed.
It's free.
I don't know.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think it is Stories. Beautiful.
Okay. You can have people call in or join in, and I listen to a few things on that.
Yep. Yeah, you could do. Yeah. I think you could do stream on it and things like that on the.
Yeah.
On the,
yeah.
Really?
So keep that in mind. Yeah, keep it in mind.
So you put your link to your live stream, or you just connect. Well, now that Elon Musk is there, I have no idea what that's going to do. He'll probably have to charge you for it because he's trying to monetize Twitter. It was.
Yeah.
I know. It won't be free for very long.
Well, then he'll lose business. Traffic,
that's true.
Right?
That's true.
Okay.
I just played a segment of dead people. This guy, he's a doctor.
Yeah.
What's really interesting about that is, like I was saying, 5 years ago, when my mother passed, when did she pass? Well, anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It. She was saying a lot of stuff that wasn't coherent. She was saying a lot of stuff when towards the end of her life that she was talking to people who passed before her. Just talking to dead people. It was my first experience on that.
Yeah.
And when she finally went, she just screamed out, "I'm ready to go."
Yeah.
And I thought it was really weird. And I wonder if that calls. I read. I've seen this. And then we talk about death. Like, you know, I talked to clergy. I had this one clergy. I said, you know, and hang in with me. It ties into the holidays. It ties into something else. Just hang in with me. So I talked to clergy about death, and they have their own. One clergy said, and I really like him. He said, ask what happens when you die. He goes, nothing. You're dirt. You're worm food. Until Jesus will come one day. And he'll awaken everybody, and then he'll take you to this marvelous place called heaven.
Mm-hmm.
I said, so you're in the ground until Jesus comes? He goes, yes. But Jesus hasn't come in 3,000 years. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Foolish, huh?
I respect you. I like you. You got to get the hell off my porch. Get out of here.
Yeah.
Because it contradicts what I've seen. So I'm hearing what happens to death, and then I get a lot of people. I mean, damn, if I put up ghosts or put up psychics or I put up this, I should have put, what's her name, my psychic in here. God, if I put that subject, it floods the studio.
Pat Oberlin.
She is my best. She's a psychic to hammer. As much as... But if I put that subject up there, it floods the studio, man. If I mean, I'm not kidding you. I'll get 10, 15 people in there because they're fascinated.
Yeah.
You're fascinated with death. You're fascinated with the future. You're fascinated with the spiritual world. People are so fascinated that they conjure up stuff. They even have little rituals and religion of Wiccan and witches and warlocks and sex. Well, I said sect, you know, like a sect of a religion.
Right.
I mean, people are fascinated with death and their fear of death. And the suicide rate for teenagers is unbelievable, off the charts.
You know what? You know what's happening around here? Probably if you live in a big area, people are just dying like flies.
Yes.
It's constant car accidents. And the thing over the weekend was vehicles driving into businesses.
Oh, you got that too? In California, it's almost like every weekend.
What the heck? That's something new. I guess there was one in Boston that somebody drove into an Apple store.
Yeah.
Mike came upon one Friday night in New Hampshire that somebody had driven into a restaurant.
Yep.
So,
we got
him
here in California. Yeah, Anne Hayes probably started, she went viral. But
yeah,
we got those in California. We got people crashing in houses, 7-Elevens. You know.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's done
like
on purpose, but.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But people making mass exodus. I guess that's what I was getting at, it seems like.
I guess you're right.
You know.
But we're fascinated. I mean, Stanley admit that he doesn't believe in God, but I think he does. At a certain point.
No.
Okay.
No, I don't believe it. If the problem with God is the problem with evil. If there is a God, how can you accept that people are dying and things like that? If there is a God, how can you accept a woman, a young kid getting raped by something? I wouldn't accept evil.
There has to be a balance, Stanley. There's light and dark. There has to be a balance.
Do you hear what she said, Sammy? Maybe that wasn't God.
Yeah.
See, you're blaming all that on God. Maybe that wasn't God. When a little child's getting raised.
I am blaming it on God because God.
No, but if you believe in God, then you have to also believe in evil exists too. So, I mean, it's not fair to put all. And I'm being an advocate here.
It took me a while, Stanley, to even grasp that concept. And once you do, it makes sense.
Yes, I understand, beautiful, but God is almighty. God could see the past,
but
the present, and the
just
future.
But evil is powerful, Stanley.
I know,
yes.
But
just
God could change the thing to make you not go through.
You know why, Stanley?
Are you saying that? Why?
Because we have free will. I wish Laverne could call in. I know she's not home. Because this is a subject she's really good at.
So, too, you're live on the air.
Hey, good morning, Brian.
What's up?
Is that King?
Hello?
King.
Yeah.
Is that King?
I recognize his voice. Good to hear from you, King. There you go.
Yeah. Good morning.
Stanley's
good morning.
Here, King. Melissa's here. King, I'm glad you came in.
Good morning,
because
King.
You
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning.
Good morning.
Sammy. I was one time, here it is, I was watching a football game, really into it. It's like a playoffs or something. Really interested. Wanted to see this game all week. I go, okay. Well, before I do this, it was a commercial. I'll go on Facebook, see what's going on. I might set up the show for the next day. I see this link from King. I'm going, okay. I go, what's going on with King? You know, it's a Sunday. You know what I mean? What's going on with King? You know, maybe I'm thinking, okay, he has hangover, girl in his apartment, he's called the cops, she still won't leave, and he wants to ask my advice. I'm thinking all this shit because it's Sunday. Oh, shit. If I hit this link, maybe this is a murder scene. King probably killed somebody. Oh, God. I don't know. But, you know, I'm there for kink. I hit this link. It's all true. I hit this link, not knowing where I was going. I'm hitting the link because King said, hey, hit the link, bro. I go, okay, bro, I'm hitting the link. I got to. It's Sunday. I'm hitting the link. I got 30 seconds. Another commercial is coming up. I got some time. I'm watching the game. I can't wait for the game. I got everything ready, the beer, everything. I got time to hit that link. I got one more commercial. Hit the link. Next thing you know, I'm in church with King. I go, what?
I went that day. I went to church with King.
Did you go Did you go to church?
I did. When King and I used to be friends. Yeah, I went to church.
Oh,
with
come
him.
On. You guys are still friends.
I love King.
King, are you friends with Melissa?
No, but I can rescind one if she wants me. If she's tired.
No. See? No, but are you generally friends right now? Forget Facebook, just friends. Yeah, there you go. There you go.
I did. I went to church that day with you, both of you.
Were you there in church?
Yes.
I was there at church.
Yes.
King was a holy roller, hands up and praying. God, the preacher's preaching.
He got thrown out of church and caught on fire, and they threw you out.
Yeah, that was out there in Phoenix, but I'm back here at home now, so, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How are your kids doing? Do they like where they are?
They're doing good. They're happy to be here. You know, they like it. They like
good.
It better here. Get out there. But they miss their
good.
Friends and whatnot there though. But
yeah.
they like
yeah.
it here. Oh. So.
Well.
Hey Kim, do you remember when we won that cake for the kids?
Oh yeah.
He was my partner. And I'm gonna tell you something. What's true about King. King is not stupid.
We got to bring some more people on there, get some more free stuff. That was fun.
That was fun. It was for the kids.
For the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
We got some beautiful kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We want.
That was good. We used to have fun doing that.
We have fun, but, you know, go back to the serious subject because I'm looking in this room right now, and we got two single people right now. We got one single man who's a family man who has three great kids. We got one single guy running around, you know, Stanley, well, we won't mention his name, running around free, Willie.
Yeah.
It's probably coming. It's the holiday. And the reason...
What do you mean
reason,
I'm running around? I'm not running around.
You're running around.
Running
Willie
around.
Willie.
The quality of women just dropped. We don't have beautiful like beautiful anymore in this world. Women are like playing games, don't want to go out with
like
men. You got money? You got the $100,000, $1 million, you're 6 foot. If you're not there, goodbye. Bye-bye. No, you don't have $1 million. You're done. Women don't even look at you. You got your own place.
That's crazy.
Yes. You got your own car. Yes. You get a six-figure salary. No. Bye bye. No one to know nothing. Yes.
Wow.
Jeez.
You're right, though.
Crazy.
Well, a friend of mine. And so I'm glad you guys are here because I need a female perspective and I need two guys' perspective, especially two single men. I really do need this. So a friend of mine, she's going to remain nameless, and she is. She was really in love with her husband, man. I'm talking like Sarge was in love with his wife, or still is, you know what I mean? I'm talking her husband was her life for so many years. So many years. I'm talking 20, 30 years maybe.
Wow.
But apparently he died recently of cancer. He died. Turned her life upside down. 3 years ago he died of cancer. She's been on a spiral ever since. And I've been reading her post. I talked to her. I haven't seen her for a while. Pages are being hacked like crazy. I'm getting new pages, and people are not following me anymore.
I know.
Whatever.
I know. Facebook has been weird lately.
Yeah, I'm hoping to leave it pretty soon. But I got in, I was thinking of her, and I got in contact with her, and I was reading her post. And they're really pressing post. Basically, she did. She can't get over this great guy.
Yeah.
That she loved so much for so many years. So when I did get in contact with her, she started to date.
That's good.
But she made the mistake. She's a very attractive, beautiful lady, but she made the mistake of dating a younger guy.
Hmm.
Now, here's her words. I was with someone who I loved for almost 32 years. 32 years. He's been gone 4 years now. September 25th. I don't know how to talk about my life without saying his name. I really only have 4 years without him. That's me grieving his loss. So here, okay, don't talk to me if you don't want to hear about him, because I am every bit a better woman because that man loved me more than anything in life.
Oh, wow. Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Now I can.
Hello?
I hear you now.
Yes, I hear you now.
Did you hear anything I said about this woman at all?
Yes, some of it.
Kind of went out
of posted on Facebook. Yeah, some of it.
Some of it?
But
all right, sum it up.
She's been married 32 years, and she talked about him to her friends, you know. Yeah, yeah.
She's having a hard time going on with her life. Can you guys hear? I mean, how do I say it? Maybe we could have a co after I'm do a sentence, we go, I hear you. Just somebody say, I hear you, so that I know that I'm, because I can't tell if you don't hear. Okay. Oh, Stanley dropped. I don't know if he can come back in the studio or not. And I'm afraid to refresh this page, because if I do, I might lose everybody.
Yeah, don't do it.
I just took a shot.
You know what? Do it and take the chance. Take the chance.
I'll take the shot. I got to take the shot.
Okay.
It's waiting too long. It hasn't refreshed yet. Oh, got an error.
Excellent.
Got an error. I can't get in the studio again. Fucking Facebook. Can you still hear me, though? Because I might still be broadcasting.
Yes, I hear you. I hear you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And thank you, because I really need both of you guys. Advice on this. Oh, I'm back in the studio. Yay.
Okay.
Whew.
Now he's out. This is crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Blog talk per usual, right?
I know, right?
people pay a lot for that.
Yeah, yeah.
They had to fix it.
Yeah, I was thinking about doing something, but if I do, I'd rather just do it on Instagram, and if it can just come on there, you know, or my artist page, you know, that I have on Facebook. So, because Blog Talk is fine, but
don't waste the money.
There's different things that they will cut you off on, and it's like, wait a minute, you know, you guys got to do better than this.
Yep. Did you hear what I was saying earlier? You can used to be able to go on Twitter and do stories, and you can go live on there.
Oh, yeah. They took that off, and then Elon Musk.
Did they take it away?
Yeah, they took that away. You can't do the stories. You can't go live. Like, Elon Musk bought it now, so I don't know what he's going to do to it. But he seemed like he's getting ready to re-fit and make it better, but we just have to wait and see.
I hope so.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's a different, very different platform now.
I like Instagram better than Twitter.
Oh, yeah. I don't even really hardly use Twitter like that anymore, really. I mean, my Instagram is, I get more traffic on Instagram than anything. Just like, the one actor who played in Baywatch, like me and her, she had followed me on Instagram. I think her name was Erica Eleniak or something like that. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
if I
know who you're
wrong.
Talking about. Yeah.
And then I get all kind of different, you know, it's just nice. And so I have a better following and stuff on Instagram. Facebook, I don't really, Facebook, I just try to keep everything G-rated. So.
Yeah.
PG-13, try to keep it PG-13, you know, because Facebook is just.
Right.
It's been out of control. And then, you know, they're just letting any and everybody just hack your page and this and that. So.
Yep. Yep.
I'm very careful on Facebook, you know, so.
Facebook is, I noticed, like, Brian's page, that somebody must have got into his new page because somebody's posting, have you seen it, all the weight loss stuff, tagging him in it? Have you seen that?
No. I don't know what page he lost, but I know it's this. So far, since I've known him, this is like his second page to me, you know.
Yep. Yep.
And this second page just recently, I don't know who's messed with it or not, but I haven't seen anything.
Watch
so.
It come up and it says Brian Hammer Jackson tagged, and it's like a woman with weight loss, and I'm like, what the heck? I forgot to tell
you
about it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I keep my page clean. I don't.
The only page that I have that's public is the Late Fan page and then my Instagram. I don't really do too much of the Facebook public.
I don't know. Big Brother is watching, right? And it is true.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think he's gone. I'm surprised he hasn't texted me.
Yeah, I think he's probably trying to get in. No.
Let me text him.
How's your grandchildren doing?
Excellent. They're getting big. They're getting big.
I bet they are.
Yeah. Yeah, one just turned 2 a couple weeks ago. And one will be 4. Yeah. Yep. They're doing good. Yep. They still live with me.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can hear you now.
Yes, I hear you.
I had a call in on my cell, so you're on my cell now. So maybe I won't be interrupted.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad to see you're all here. 111, you're live on the air.
Yeah, we've just been gabbing away.
I'm good. Thank you.
Find you at your point in time and place, but when I get on here, you just drop off the air.
Oh, I don't even know how.
Man, I'm telling you, man, I'm going to start beating you upside the head and shoulders eventually.
This
I'm going to beat you for no other reason than just that.
this is not my fault. I'm trying my best to keep. In fact, everybody give a round of applause for Melissa, man, holding the show together because when I'm not here telling me you can hear me. No, seriously, man. She
well, you don't deserve her, Brian. That's all I got to say. You don't deserve her. You should be grateful. You should be groveling on your knees that you have Melissa to take up your slack when you screw things up.
True. There you go, Melissa.
Yeah, I mean, and then you want to blame things. You sound like AOC in this nightclub murder, slaughter the other day, trying to blame Lauren Boebert for it.
Which one? What's going on, Sarge? What's going on?
In the nightclub shooting attack in Colorado happened last night.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
She tried to blame Lauren Boebert. It's not, it didn't even happen in her district. But, of course, the idiot AOC has to blame Lauren Boebert for it because Lauren Boebert won't go along with her, quote, common sense gun legislation, unquote. Whatever that's supposed to mean. And the facts ain't even in yet.
Yeah.
This is typical of these demagogues. They do it all the time. pats me down. And now, from what I'm hearing, and I'm not sure if it's true or not, I'm hearing that this guy had been picked up and he was let loose. He had already been picked up for some other offense and he got let out. Now, I'm not sure about that. Don't hold me to it, but that's the rumors I'm hearing. It wouldn't surprise me because I ain't heard nothing about his motives yet. It probably ain't something the mainstream media can blame on MAGA and Donald Trump. That's the reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it was, they'd have been saying it right away. They'd have been saying right away, oh, more hate from MAGA and right-wing conservatives. But you don't hear it much, do you? Other than from an idiot like AOC.
Well, you know what? I am so sorry. I'm both sides. You still got what's her name on your side too. It's just extreme people on both sides. I'm tired of the drama.
That was terrible.
You got your Marjorie Greene. You got your AOC. You got your both sides. It's just tired of it. And as soon as somebody gets killed with a gun, here we go with the same conversation. You know, protect your amendment. Here we go. The Dems want to take your guns, and then the Republicans. You're not taking my guns, you bastard. It's so tiring for the argument.
No,
they
can't have my gun, Brian. Look, they want to buy back my gun. I got a sell price. The price is $1.5 million. But lately I've been reconsidering it. I'll give the government a 50% discount and bring it down to $1 million.
That's
right. That's what I want for each one of my AR-15s. They want to buy them back. I want $1 million. Now, if they don't want to pay it, fine, I'll just keep them.
Hey, wait, before we leave, I don't want to lose anybody. King's still here. King, Sarge is here, Melissa and everything. I need you guys' advice, and especially yours, Sarge,
okay.
Before we get into the other stuff. We have a friend of ours who is in trouble. We have a friend who's in trouble, okay? Meaning when she's in trouble is that she loved this man for 2 years. It was her heart and soul. Sarge, you could relate to her.
Okay.
In fact, I'm going to read you her so you can actually relate this. Listen to this. I was with someone who I loved for almost 32 years. He's been gone now for 4 years. He died of cancer, September 25th. I don't know how to talk about my life without saying his name. I really only had 4 years without him, and that's grieving, and that's me grieving his loss. So here's what I have to say. Don't talk to me if you don't want to hear about him. Because I am every bit a better woman because that man loved me more than anything in life. That post was October 5th. She's having a hard time coping right now. I reached out to her. So here's the problem. She's a woman over 45. I'm going to be really honest. She's not listening. Maybe a woman over 50. Okay. Okay. She's a black woman, by the way. So I reached out to her not too long ago just to see how she was doing. And it's been like 2 years since I've been talking to her. I know her husband. I talked to him. Great people. Great people. I seen her post. So I reached out to her. And she was kind of happy because she just met him. She goes, I'm dating now, Brian. And I was happy that she was moving on. I go, okay. And she was dating a younger guy. I, in my back of my mind, I'm going, uh-oh, minefield. Careful where you step. This shit could blow up in your face. You know what I'm saying? I said it in the back of my mind, okay? I'm a realist. Now, here's the post. Hey, my Facebook family. This was 2 days ago. Hey, my Facebook family. I finally decided to date, which is why I've been away from SM. I don't know what SM, I don't know what that is. Anyway, this is on Facebook. I got my heart broken. Tell me how to rebound. Apparently, I'm really not good at this at all. I just miss being married. Starting over sucks. Hashtag dating sucks. Hashtag speak love. Hashtag act with love. Hashtag be love. Hashtag we connected. Hashtag heartbroken. So it sounds like it. Now, when I connected with her, she was trying on outfits. You know how women, you know, make themselves feel better? She was trying on outfits. She looks great, great spirit. And she was showing me some of the really, casual wear or what, you know, pictures of her in casual or informal gear. I said, oh, these look nice, really nice, right? So mm-hmm. I asked her, well, how does your new boyfriend think? She goes, he says it's disgusting. And he hates everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I could gather, he may be 5 to 10 years younger than her. She's a black woman. And so here's, well, you know me. You know me. You know me. I'm going to reply to this. I'm going to reply. So here's what I said. I said, dating is not kind to women over 45. It's not. It's not. Women is horrendous. It is. Sorry, but true. But there is a way to move the odds in your favor, though. Hashtag am I dateable? Am I dateable? Hashtag. That's what I said, which is true. I didn't say anything out of the ordinary. Am I right, Sarge? Am I right, everybody? Am I right, David? Oh, damn it. Am I missing who else is here? King, am I right?
Man, think about it for a minute, man. Who you decide to date and or marry is an economic decision. It always is, if you really think about it. What is this person going to bring to my life? What value does this person bring to my life? And, of course, she's going to ask herself the same question. What value does this guy bring to my life? It's always an economic question, even if it doesn't involve currency. So let's not kid ourselves about it. Now, you got to ask yourselves, what do you bring that is of value to a relationship? You can't say that I'm older and therefore I should be considered because I'm older. Look, my girlfriend is like 38, and she gives herself an old maid. And I said, what do you think that makes me feel like every time you tell me you're an old maid and you're 38
right.
years old? You know?
Right.
But she does it all the time. You know what I mean?
Child molester?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it really gets kind of irritating. But that doesn't mean you're not valuable because you're older. If you can bring
right.
something of value to someone, you got to look at yourself and you got to sum up your assets and your liabilities. And if your assets outweigh your liabilities, you can bring something to your relationship. You've got to have confidence that those assets will sell themselves. And if they do, you're
well,
in business.
I agree with you, Sarge, but, you know, this woman, and I need you guys to chime in, this woman is broken. Easy mark. Easy mark, easy mark. I got laid by so many divorcees because of this, and they were great because they were broken. They were tossed. They were trash. They were tossed. Society did not want them. They were fine pickings for me to bang them one night and send them on their way. They were low-hanging fruit. The older you are, the hornier you are, you want this good, you want this young stuff. Oh, man, did I have a good time.
Brian,
do
you not
you
understand
know.
That I know what she's going through because I was broken after my wife fucked me?
Yeah.
That's why I'm saying what I'm saying. I understand the vulnerability.
Yeah.
And I'm saying you got to slap yourself out of it.
That well,
was
see,
3 years
thing,
without
sorry.
A relationship. 3 fucking years. You know, I was literally in the wilderness.
Wow.
Man, so I'm just trying to explain to you, man, that yes, I understand all this. That doesn't mean you're supposed to wallow in it.
Yeah.
You've got to snap yourself out. Now, how you do
sorry,
that
I
is going to depend on you. There aren't any hard and fast rules, but you've got to do it eventually, or else you will mire yourself in misery.
Yeah. Sorry.
And self-pity.
I think they call it complicated grief when somebody...
There you go, Melissa. You just...
self-pity,
you'll die really
yep.
sad.
Yep. Yep.
She set her, I agree with both of you guys, she set herself up for it. Because you got, when you, and you said it, Sarge, and Melissa, you I like how you defined it, but you when you're not, for dating is a blood sport. And I said that. I should have a book, Dating is a Blood Sport. It is. You have to be on. You have to have so much confidence in yourself for the rejection, maybe, because chances are when you're dating, you don't really have a good crop of people Because usually, depending on the age, I say over 32, majority of them are losers and psychos. And you don't have, it's not, and it's slim pickings. Why the hell do you have to go on a dating app? I mean, you can't meet nobody. You cannot meet nobody at a sports bar or a bowling alley or a grocery store. Hell, grocery store, they're picking me up like crazy. I go in my car and the lady goes, "You're a grown man. Why are you having Fruit Loops?" Get out of my car, lady. I have to make excuses that I have invisible children at home when they see my car. Oh, my kids. Oh, those kids. I go, I know. Leave my card alone.
I think women have a different take on this. Let me. I was talking to a friend who lost her husband. She's 10 years older than me, to cancer about 4 years ago. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, dating and things like that. And I said, you know, I said, as you get, you know, a little older, I said, you take solace in your family, in your grandchildren, rather than going out, you know. That's how I felt. And she agreed. She said that nobody would ever measure up to her husband. So why bother?
I know,
right?
I know what you mean. Yep.
Yep. So we both kind of like had this idea and agreed on it that your family becomes like, you know, paramount, you know. Yeah.
But women tend to do that. They would start getting themselves involved in their grandchildren and their family.
Yeah.
And because, again, I'm saying women don't need the grief. You know what I mean? If they find themselves over 50 or 55 and they're single all of a sudden, and it's, what do you call it when people leave the house? I forgot what they call it.
Emptiness.
But they, the emptiness, they did it.
Am I still full of damn eggs? It never emptied up?
Empty nest syndrome, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I had that for about 8 months. Yeah.
All right. I think what it does is it liberates women. They're done with the kids. The kids are grown up. They love their grandbabies.
Right.
I mean, grandbabies are like my, I'm going to be honest with you, grandbabies are like my, what do you call it, with Superman, my kryptonite. You got to love the grandbabies. The grandbabies are everything.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
They don't need, if a man's 45, he's already set in his ways. He's set in his ways. There's no, when you're younger, like 20, 30, you grow together, you do this together, you compromise with each other, you're growing together. Now you're dating at a certain age of 50 and over. You're already setting your ways. Your kids are gone. Your grandkids are there. And then some guy comes in and you have to compromise your lifestyle. And he's set in his ways too. He's set in his ways. So what do you do?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go younger. So the younger people are already, let's say you're dating younger. You're over 45. Let's say you're dating younger. You're a target now. You're the young dude, I hate to tell you, the young dude is not looking for your eggs to have a baby. You're already talking grandkids, and you're probably dating somebody who's maybe 10 years older than your own children. So he's not looking for you to be a mother of his children. So what is he looking for? There's two
things.
Well,
he may already have
for.
Children of his own, too.
Well, he may. But he may.
Well,
but if she's dating if she's dating younger, he may have children, or he's a newly grandparent. But she's, you know, she's done. I mean, 45, 47, 50. She's done. She's done.
Well, Brian, look, I got to tell you something, Brian. Look, when I dared to look into starting another relationship, I was using dating apps like crazy. And I met a couple of really nice women who probably, in ordinary circumstances, I would have got along with very nicely. But the whole thing seemed forced and artificial. And it was me more than it was them. That's why it didn't work out. And I didn't get anywhere with any of it, and it was very frustrating and disappointing. The reason I'm with this woman I'm with right now is because we met in a totally natural way. Like, I don't know if I told you this before, but we met because she was making friends with my dog while I was loading groceries into my truck.
Yeah,
right.
And I'm loading groceries in my truck, and she's up there making friends with my dog. And my dog really hooked me up with this lady because she liked him. And I said, wait, he doesn't like anybody. He usually would bite somebody who do what you did. But for some reason, he likes you.
Yeah.
Right.
And everything went just folded naturally from that.
There you go.
You've got to love a woman.
I don't know. Maybe the dating apps require you to put on some sort of airs or be prepared to meet some sort of expectation that you can't really, and you're on your guard. Maybe they were too. But whatever it was, it didn't work out too well, and I could tell it wasn't going to. Even though these are probably women in normal circumstances, I probably would have got along pretty good with.
Well, it requires people to put their best foot forward, and that's not us all the time. You know,
yeah,
it's not
I mean,
me.
When I stopped thinking how the woman I'm with now, I met her, was, like I said, it was just
natural.
Spontaneous and natural and kind of fun in a lot of ways,
right.
You know?
It's
yeah.
kind of like you have to bring your application and your resume. So,
exactly.
Sorry, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it's like, oh, and I'm looking at your resume, and it says you like this and like dogs. And it's like, oh,
and that's
God,
the way
so
I met
awesome.
My wife. I saw my wife in the lobby at the post office, in the main post office in Chicago. I thought she was really
right.
cute. And I walked up to her and I said, hey, you know, I don't know. Listen, pardon me, ma'am. I don't know who you are. But I wish I did. Do you mind if I ask? And boom, it hit it from there. I never forget the first
right.
words. Those are the first words I said to her. Pardon me, ma'am. I don't know who you are, but I wish I did know. And do you mind if I ask? And she laughed, and everything clicked.
Wow, look at you, you smooth talker. I had that similar experience. I saw this girl, seriously, fell head over heels. She was on the corner. I said, ma'am, I don't know how you know who you are, but how much? She said, well, it'll be $35 an hour. I go, oh, okay. So, yeah, it was love at first sight. But we were so in love for 1 hour. I didn't, and we broke up.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I
That's
guess you could say you're never not in love with some woman you're stuffing. For at least the time you're stuffing her, right? Yeah, okay.
After an hour, it becomes nagging and annoying and everything. You just want to date again. I wait until the next payday to date again. But I hear what you're saying. It's the natural thing. You just people say when you least want to meet someone, that's when you do. Because they're not putting their best foot forward. They're being human, you know? And that's what attracts us to people. It's like, when you're lying or you want to be something else or your persona is your alter ego, one to date.
Right. Now, even though I'm considerably older than this woman I'm with now, the reason she likes me is because I am older, not because I'm just older. She's got a father fixation because I know how to do a lot of things. She says most of the men she knows, they can't do it. They can't fix anything. They don't know how anything works. They have no knowledge of anything whatsoever, and they're boring. She likes the fact that, you know, something goes – or haywire, like plumbing or basic carpentry or something goes wrong with a car, I know how to fix it. She loves that. And she loves that I know about a lot of things a lot of people don't know about. She loves it.
How
she says
you
the
know
biggest
what,
problem she's had with the younger men she knows is they don't know how to do anything. They don't know how anything works.
I hear your story and I can relate to it. I was on a plane with my girlfriend. We've been together for over 20 years. I was on a plane. She hates being on the plane with me because I'm like a child, but I am. And she treats me like a child, and I hate it. You got your seatbelt on. You know what it is. You got your snacks. I go there above. You can't eat your snacks until they take you. I mean, come on, Sarge. I'm a grown-ass man. I can eat my snacks when I want to eat my snacks. You can't eat your snacks until we're ready to take off. You know, she's a rule player. Always by the rules, right? And I looked at her, and I said, you know, we've been together for – so many years. I'm like you, Sarge. And I asked her, and I shouldn't have asked her, why are we together? I mean, she goes, what are you doing? I said, we're talking. We're having a conversation. She goes, this is a good one. You're not going to like it. Okay. I just said, why are we together? I mean, with your ex-husband, it was a perfect relationship. And I was being sarcastic. And
obviously
she said,
not.
Yes, it was. No, she said it was. He is everything. She, this is why she said, you're not going to like this conversation. I go, okay. And she goes, he is everything, really. Now I'm sitting with her. And I go, oh, do tell, because we got a long sight, woman. And she said, he was dependable. He was reliable. He was mature. He had a stable. He was stable. I'm hearing all this stuff that I'm not. And I'm here, so I go to her, and I said, I'm confused. I had a really confused look at my face, and I said, well, why are you with me? And she says, he was boring. I knew what was going to happen every night. I knew what he wanted for dinner every night. Nothing changed. I knew what he wanted to sit down. I knew when he wanted to go this. It was just almost a dead, what do you call the thing when you're straight line, flat line relationship. There were no peaks and valleys. I go, uh-huh. And I said, well, what about me? She goes, oh, God, you're like a, you know, earthquake center. You're up and down, up and down, up and down. You're never boring. I go, that's pretty cool, right? She goes, little less peaks and valleys I could take. But, yeah, you keep me on my toes. You're exciting. I never know what's going to happen with you. I don't know what's going to come out of your damn mouth. And you make me laugh. You're just weird. I go, cool. That's rock. I accepted it. So when you said boring, Sarge, she said the same thing. It was the same thing every day. Every day, nothing changes. Same routine. And she said she stopped living. So.
Yep. So, yeah, but like I said, you know, I think we're starting to get to the nub of the matter here now that if your friend who has this problem, you know, she's older and she's trying to figure out she's going to get in the dating scene and all that. Look, she's lived that long. She surely has things that are of value about her, things about her that are of value that she's accumulated over a lifetime. She's probably either downplaying them or neglecting them. She's only looking at one thing. That, let's face it, when it comes to women, as a general rule, women have more value in the marketplace. And again, dating and marriage is literally an economic transaction. Let's not fool ourselves. Even with the romance involved, it still essentially is. What she's not doing is looking at what she has of value and what she should emphasize in order to, if you will, sell herself. And that's what I think a lot of women, particularly older women who come out, the only thing they see, the only real obstacle they see in front of them is, I'm older. I don't have as much value in the dating commodity scene or marketplace as a younger woman does. And generally speaking, that's true. But tell me something. Who is going to turn down Jennifer Lopez for some young dummy who don't even know what she wants to do for a living? Yeah. Come on.
I hear you.
So, you know, I mean, it just is not as cut and dry as they like to put it. Again, it's always, look, if you want to meet any challenge, you're going to have to overcome obstacles. Okay, and I get that. And I'm not trying to minimize or ignore that reality. But still, you can do it. You got to find the right person and who understands what you have to bring of value and find that person. And it might be tough to find them, but you got to keep looking. That is if you don't want to be sad and lonely. Did you drop off, Brian? Anybody hear me?
I hear him. I hear you.
Oh, okay.
Whoever that
I didn't hear nothing, so I was wondering.
Can you guys hear me? Can you guys?
Yeah,
I hear you now.
Okay.
Yeah.
My girlfriend's here. She's a hostile witness. She doesn't want to be on the air, but I'm cornered here because I want to ask her a question. Oh. Now, baby, am I the best man you ever been with?
No.
Okay.
You
can
do bullshit like that.
Okay. Love you.
You got a good woman there. She's honest.
I know. What a good woman that woman is.
Yeah, yeah. You ought to be glad for that.
We're so happy together. Now let's move on. You see how happy? No. All right. Love you. You would have
to
know.
Look on the bright side, Brian. That doesn't mean you're bad. It just means you're not
the
best. You might be number two, number three, number four, number five. Who knows? So, you know what I mean? It's not necessarily a bad thing. You might be the second or the third.
No.
You know, it's like trying to say, Drew Brees to Tom Brady, you know? They're both still great, right?
No,
right?
She's just being mean. Yeah, she's just being
mean.
Okay,
so, you know, don't be downhearted. Don't be downhearted.
Oh, I'm not.
It wasn't necessarily an insult.
I'm sure Laverne's laughing her ass off right now. But anyways, Sarge, no, she doesn't. She's just kidding. But she likes to do that to me, put me on the spot. She has a sense of humor just like me, but hers is more warped.
That's good, man. That means you probably have a good relationship.
Laverne?
We do. We've been again. No, I'm talking to
Cindy. Cindy is very logical, from what I hear. Cindy's like Spock, right? Dr. Spock. That's how I perceive it. Yep.
She's a lot logical. So anyway.
But you need that. You need that.
I love putting her in situations, and she gets back at me when I do. That's basically our relationship. You put me in a situation, you're not going to like my answer, so there. I'm getting back at you. And then she goes, I love you, but you put me on air again, I'm going to tell him I hate you. All right, that's fair. I know
that's
I'm expect
right.
what I expect.
She doesn't hate you. She doesn't.
No, over 20 years, are you kidding me? I'm the best that woman ever had. All right. Let's see where we are. Stanley dropped.
Stanley did drop. That's too bad because I think he – let's go back into this death thing, you know, if you want to.
Wait, into the what thing?
The death.
The death.
It was like when people – he had some guy – talking about death and how he viewed it, and it's really I think it's an interesting subject, and I think that a lot of people are really afraid of death, right?
So I was going with this. You're right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Melissa. Go ahead.
Well, it's made me think. You know, the older you get, there's not a lot of people left around, right?
Right.
Your family are gone. A lot of your family's gone.
Yeah,
and it's kind of like, it's a strange thing, right? In the holidays, it kind of brings it out. My mother passed away right before Thanksgiving. She passed November 16th. I had to remind myself of this, 2014. So I'm looking at the obituary. And we had a memorial service on the 21st, so right around Thanksgiving, right? And it was a strange Thanksgiving. It was a really weird thing, right? And, you know, everybody was kind of like, it was a sudden death. It wasn't a lingering death. She died very suddenly. And so that freaked us all out, you know what I mean? But I don't know. It's part of life, right? And my mother was very happy before she died. And she was talking about people in the family that had passed away a lot. So I don't know if that was something she knew, especially this one uncle who she hadn't talked about in years. And she kept talking about him, right? And so I don't know if that was something she was very happy. Because my mother was really kind of mean. And then right before she died, I'm going to say a month before, she was really nice. You know what I mean? It was just weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
To have that. Yeah.
Well,
so,
you know.
Both of my parents are gone, you know. Grandparents, great-grandparents, everybody is gone.
Yeah.
At this point, you know.
Both my parents are gone, too.
Yeah. I remember I met you. I don't know if your father had just passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Was it your dad? Yeah.
Yes. Probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So, and you know, I don't even think about this with dates and stuff, and I'm a date person. And my mother's death, I have to look it up.
I yeah. like sort of X'd it out, the date and everything.
And the other day, I
had a dream about her and didn't remember what date it was. But this was right the day before she passed, the anniversary of her passing away. It was really strange.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I had to look at that again, and I'm like, oh. Did it hurt? Yeah. Did I cry? Yes. It was a sudden death. So it was like freaking out, you know? But it is part of life.
Well, it is, but, you know, for me, I think, as someone who's like I said, I've witnessed a lot of deaths in real time. I've inflicted death on others, you know, and I thought about all this and what it means and, you know, what the meaning of it all is. And you go through 1,000 permutations about what death is and, you know, and your grief and loss and guilt and everything else. You go through a million permutations of it. But for me as an individual, because, of course, there are things that are universal about death to everybody and their perceptions of it and their philosophical understandings of it. But for me personally, one of my biggest fears of death is not the end of my physical existence. It is the end of knowledge. In other words, my knowledge will be frozen in the time I die in. And I get things I'm not ever going to know about.
Sarge, I look at this differently. That spiritually, I believe that we all live on. And I think that's my feeling, that the body is just a vessel. So what you've learned can never be unlearned. It's kind of universal. You know what I mean?
I get what you're saying there. Yeah, sure.
It'll never stop. That's how I feel. Some people, I remember talking to my mother before she died, and she never talked about death. And she said, well, you know, once you die, that's it. You know, you go on the ground.
Well, I've also thought that maybe death is the key to understanding everything.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Maybe that's it, too. Maybe you'll unlock everything that there is to know you'll discover after death.
Yep.
But again, that's philosophical. That's not necessarily reality. But death is so profound. We got to think about. We should think about it in a lot of different ways.
Yep.
You know.
Yep.
What does it all mean, and why are we existing? And when you stop to think of the random probability of your even living, and that's each of us. You think about how absolutely improbable it is. It's bigger than hitting the lottery that you even come to exist in the first place, if you think about
it.
Literally, it literally is. Literally odds of billions against you being born at all. So all of us hit the lottery just by being born.
True.
You think of how random the whole conceptive process is. And how many variables can go into preventing you as an individual from being born, even if you still have the same father and mother, if they just decide to have sexual intercourse on a different night, you don't get born. You don't even get conceived. So you stop to think about it or at a different time or a different location. If somebody says, hey, let's go out for a beer, hey, your whole chance is interrupted. If you think about that, that is profound in and of itself. To say nothing of death once you have attained life. So, yeah, I can see why we get so wrapped around the axle about this, because there's so many damn variables to it. And you say to yourself, well, why should something that came about as a result of a randomized astronomical chance of being, why should it even be ended at all?
Yep.
And it gives rise to all of these speculations, and I kind of like it myself. I say, let's go for it. I mean, we got the minds to explore these things. Why not talk about them?
Absolutely. I agree with you.
I don't know if anybody can.
I hear you.
Thank you. Today, this year, there'll be somebody here in the U.S. who's going to have. To face the holidays without somebody who they love for the first time.
Yeah.
The first thing.
We all do it.
First Christmas.
We've all done
it. Huh?
I mean, most
I understand.
Of us have done it.
I understand. No. There are some people, I understand, that they don't know if they can get through it because they haven't done it yet.
Well,
you know what I mean? They haven't done it.
I think that people need to look at the whole thing, and I don't know. I think some people almost enjoy the stuckness that they stay in.
Okay.
Right?
Wait, you said
well,
they almost enjoy
people,
what?
Being stuck in that grief.
Oh, you mean wallowing in their grief? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. Some
okay,
people
but I'm talking. Those are some people, and I give you those. But then there are other people. I'm thinking about that woman who's 65. Her husband, her lifelong partner, passed away this year of something. She finds herself alone. Or she finds herself with family, but she doesn't even want to attend without him. Meaning, same thing that I played, but you get what I'm saying. There's going to be a certain amount of people who's going to cease to exist because
mm-hmm.
of their partner has passed away. They feel they're nothing. They feel like my, you know what I mean? Especially when the older you get. And it's more devastating because you're alone.
But
you're
never alone.
I don't know. See, the human beings need something to do. They need to wake up. They need something. They need have something to wake up to, or as we cease to exist. Whether she's a caretaker,
yep.
whether she takes the walks with him, whether she goes to the doctor's appointment with him, whether she does PT with him, there's something, there's always something to do, but they're doing it together. And can you imagine years, and I know we don't think about this, but years and years, even just visiting an elderly person in an elderly home, and you're not in the home, you're the one who put her there. But knowing that you are going somewhere to see them, you have something to do, and when they cease to exist, you got nothing to do anymore.
But there's always something to do.
Really? I don't know. I don't know.
Well,
but,
one of the saving graces of aging, even if you lose a partner, is you may supplement some of that energy that went into mate. Finding and maintaining is diverted into other things like maybe intellectual pursuits.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. I mean, if having a significant other in life is important as it is for most human beings, then yes, it can be crippling. But let's say the worst case scenario, you know and realize you will never find another significant person in your life. Well, you've got usually the time and maybe even the inclination to sublimate those urges into other channels.
Yeah.
And you might wind up doing
something,
making a great discovery or some great personal revelation or some aid or assistance to others that makes up for it.
You know, you've got to
look good that can come along with the bad, too, sometimes.
My
yeah.
friend that her husband died, and she got really into a hobby that she hadn't done for years. And now she is crocheting the world. And it's
there you go.
Beautiful.
It ain't necessarily bad. I mean, it really is. I mean,
I know
the most fulfilling thing, at least for me in my life ever, was my relationship with my wife, really, ultimately, the best thing that ever happened to me. But
yep.
even after she died, I still found a lot of things to do that I thought were engrossing and stimulating.
She
so,
said
you know, I mean,
mentally with grief, and it this
yeah, you bide your time until you
yeah.
find your opportunity. It doesn't mean your opportunity won't ever come along.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
I didn't think I was
going to
have one
until
I met
a
particular woman. I
yeah.
did, and I met her purely by accident. I mean, she just hit
mm-hmm.
up on my wary, paranoid dog who would normally bite somebody who did what she did.
Hmm.
But he liked her. He just saw so many like. He liked her. He was like wagging his tail and all friendly. I mean, I know you smell kind of nice, but I mean, you know, dogs don't necessarily interpret nice smelling things as things to be happy about. Not necessarily.
I know. I have one dog that's terrible. She hates everybody. Hates everybody. I don't know what.
But
it
he
is.
Didn't hate everybody. He just worried. My dog's very protective when I'm around.
And I think that's what it is.
Any stranger who would come up to him when I'm around is a target.
Yeah.
And he just took to her like, you know, a duck to water. I mean, started liking her right away.
You know what so I read this morning, and it was good you brought up because you talked about depression and things before the holidays. And I think, and it works for, I think it really works, is gratitude for everything. Having gratitude rather than looking at the worst of everything.
Well, it's
just gratitude. You've got a roof over your head, blankets on your bed, running water.
Yeah, but see, some women, and these are usually old school women, will put everything 100% in their husband. No other interest. Their interest is their husband and his well-being and being a housewife, which is nothing wrong with that. I think it's a great honor and it's a hard job. So all your life that you're putting all that in and you're having this really great relationship, and then all of a sudden as you get older and later in life, he's gone. And you've been putting
painful.
All...
Well, that's painful. It's terrible. But you know what? I don't know where you... We've been married for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think, you know, it could happen to either one of us, right? And I do think, you know, I did the other day. What if he didn't come home today? How would I feel? Swear to God, isn't that strange? And it was a fleeting thought, but you know what? It would really hurt for a while, and I would probably miss him until the end of my life. But it wouldn't end my life.
You know,
but you
got a safety net. It was the thing about we used to think about. I used to think the same thing with my mother. You know, my mother was my life. She still is my life. She's everything about her I admire. Being a single mom, being strong, being educated, being loyal, being true, just everything about her. And I always worried about her demise, and I always thought when she was still here, thinking, if she ever left, could I go on without her? And there was points where I didn't think I could. I would pray to God that take me before you take her kind of thing. You know, because I don't think I could have handled life after her if she was not here. So when we do these scenarios, I'm not being unfair. And I have these scenarios all the time. Okay, I'll pretend she's not here. Can I go on or whatever? You just don't know how you're going to react when it does happen. I'm just saying that. You just don't know. You would like to.
Unfortunately, you get better at it, right?
you do.
Yep.
I don't know what it is. They said that the Lord will not give you so much you can handle or whatever.
Yeah.
Something kicks in. And I cannot tell you what kicks in. You know, because you and I are orphans. I'm talking to you. Something, you know what I mean by that. No, we don't.
Yeah,
both are parents.
I do. Yeah.
But something kicks in. And I cannot tell you for me, I cannot tell you what kicks in, and I don't know what kicks in for you, Melissa. I don't know what kicks in for you, Sarge. But when it does, I mean, Sarge probably thought the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I love this woman more than life itself, and then I don't know what I'm going to do without this woman. And then when things happen and then something kicks, I cannot tell you what it is. I don't think we could even describe what it is. But the message is that if you are experiencing, like this woman is here, it's been 4 years, and you are experiencing that, and you think that you don't want to go to, I understand you don't want to do holidays. You don't want to see people laughing and because you're grieving so much. I understand that. I understand that you don't want to see life keeps going and you want life to stop. And how dare
the dog barks and how dare the kid smiling on this day of you're feeling so miserably and so depressed. I understand.
Yeah.
But here's what got me going is the most of the time, unless it's sudden death and we can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying death can never be planned because death can never be planned. I know when people are saying, okay, well, it's end of life. Shut up. We don't know. Tuesday, Wednesday, when is it? I can't tell you. Shut up.
Well, I guess if somebody has a diagnosis and, you know, and they're receiving treatments.
Even then, it could be prolonged.
You know, Brian, look, you know, as someone who's experienced grief in all its forms, you know, firsthand, I got to remember what I saw one night on a hilltop when a guy just lost his best friend, and he was rocking back and forth, and he was saying, "Oh God, Smiley's dead. He's been hit. He's dead. I can't do nothing for him. He can't do nothing for him." And he was rocking back and forth. And the platoon sergeant ran up to him, grabbed him by the back of his collar, shook him, and said, "Yeah, I know your buddy's dead, but we ain't got time to hold no services. Get back on that fucking machine gun."
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's what's got to be done. Maybe not that brutally, but sometimes your grief has got to be set aside for other considerations.
Mm. Well, you know, and so I agree with you, Sergeant. I agree with you, Melissa. All I can offer you is this. Anybody who thinks, and this is just new to me, but it has helped me. It almost measured. See, I'm a measured person. I like to control my fate or my destiny. Or sometimes I'll do a self-check for mental illness. And that's not meant to be as a joke. I will self-check myself. Am I still quick? And I mean, you know, that sometimes as we get older, we slow down. I would check myself. Okay, I'm still good.
Yeah, it's not necessarily bad either. If your lifetime, everything about you was revolved on activity, now you realize you got to slow down. You got to do something else.
Right. And so I said to everyone, look at the seven stages of grief. I tell you it's true. I didn't think it was true, but it is so fucking true, man. And you'll get through the seven stages. The first stage, I'm just going to say this because I'll do it really quick. The first stage that you're going to go through is shock and awe. It's going to be disbelief and shock. They're finally gone, or I got this diagnosis, whatever. And that's your first stage. You're going to feel numb. It's the initial reaction to loss includes feeling of shock. Learning someone you love is gone creates numbness and fills a person with doubt. This is a form of emotional protection that can last for weeks. The time experience often reflects the suddenness of the death, but there is no cookie-cutter recipe for grief. It is not uncommon for someone to go through the shock phases throughout the duration of funeral preparation simply to get through the process. That's stage one, is the disbelief and the shock, and you're feeling numb. Then you go to the next stage, which is denial. It reflects the stubbornness of the human spirit. I can't believe he's gone. He's
yeah.
not gone. His spirit is still here. I can still talk to him. He signs. A cup fell out of the cupboard. That's him. He's in the house. It's just the denial of it. And it's stubbornness of the human spirit. The mind goes into a state of denial to avoid the pain and the reality of loss. A person can deny a loved one's passing for weeks, no matter the circumstances around the death. People experience other kinds of denial as well. For instance, a grieving person may deny the loss affects them in a serious manner. I had that when they told me about my mom passed and my dad passed. I was in this denial thing. It's like, and I'm not saying that they're not dead, but it's like, I didn't want to think about it, you know? I don't know if I can even – I remember Cindy – I love this dog. Well, her dog's been gone for 10 years, and I looked at Cindy maybe 2 years ago, and she has the dog as her profile picture. And I said, how can you look at the dog? I mean, the dog's gone. She goes, because I love the dog, and it reminds me of the dog. I still can't put the picture of my dog up there, you know, to this day. And the dog's been gone for 8 years, 9 years. So it's like I'm in that denial thing that I haven't accepted his death. But it says, for instance, a grieving person may deny that the loss affects them in a serious manner. I'm going on with my life. He's just a dog. Denial is a type of self-preservation, much like shock. A person experienced with this stage helps shelter them from the eventual pain and the ensuing stages of grief. The third one is guilt and pain. I'm almost done, but I really believe in this. And this is, I believe in this self-help kind of thing, this chart thing, to see where you are and know that what's coming, because nobody can tell you what's going to be coming next. And they can tell you what's coming. Well, you know, I remember my girlfriend, when I first heard my mother pass, and we're walking. And I was in shock. I had no feeling. I couldn't feel anything. And then she goes, I know what you're thinking next. I go, what am I thinking? She's going, you're thinking probably the domino effect. And somebody just passed, and somebody else is going to pass next week, and somebody else is going to. And she was right. The domino effect of, oh, grandma just passed. Oh, great, grandpa just passed. Now I got my uncle. This domino effect. Well, the guilt, number three is the guilt. A person may feel survivor's guilt or constant sense of what might have been. They may feel remorse over missed opportunities or things they did not do or should have done when their loved ones were passing. It's important to experience the full depth of pain when going through grief. And this can also be divorce or separation, too. It's the same thing as seven stages. It doesn't mean just death. This is the seven stages of grief. Your dog could die. The person you care about could die, separate, divorce, whatever. It doesn't have to be with death. This can be in separation, too. And number four is bargaining. This is where I am. The negotiation phase occurs when a grieving person needs an emotional release from the shock and pain of loss. This phase involves wrestling with fate, powers that be, and they try to make sense of the loss. Of course, there is nothing one can do to bring someone back from the dead. That's the bargaining. Then you got your anger, that's number five. People go through this phrase, tend to lash out at one around them as an unwanted reaction to the feeling of helplessness. I went through five recently. The grief strains the relationship of the living. To preserve their relationship, it's imperative to find a way to release the extreme emotion in a healthy manner. Failing to do so may permanently damage ties you with the friends and coworkers. Numbers, after you get past the anger, the depression will set in. And here it is. People who have never experienced depression before have a hard time with this stage. Depression is all-encompassing and consumes your life. While it may seem extreme and worrying to go through a depression stage, it is perfectly healthy to do so when grieving. After all the energy expelled and mental anguish of the stages, depression gives you time to reflect and recover. Taking ample time to feel the loneliness and isolation makes it easy to re-enter the world when you're ready. When going through depression, avoid people who encourage you to snap out of it. For one, you cannot you want to snap out of it. You cannot control your emotions that way. Instead, let yourself feel the despair, and just as you let yourself feel the other stages. This is a significant period of reflection and recuperation. Now, finally, I'm at six. Finally, here seven, because there's seven stages. Acceptance. As a person adjusts to life without the person they grieve, the depression and other extreme feelings fade away. Common signs of acceptance include, this is where you accept shit. Reconstructing life without the person. Cleaning out the loved one's personal item, working on financial and solving problems, seeking out old relationship and support system, and beginning new projects or hobbies. Emma, can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got you. Hey, Brian, I'm going to tell you something, man. I'm actually, you know, in an odd sort of way, I'm actually kind of appreciative of grief, because I think grief is a sign of how much that person meant to you. If you didn't grieve for them, then it couldn't have been very important to you. So in a way, grief serves as a benchmark, a hallmark of how valuable that human being was to you.
Yeah.
Sure. But there are people who don't know that they're grieving. There are people who are just leashing out and they're questioning themselves, why am I doing this? You know, it's overwhelming to them. They're acting in a certain way. They're depressed. They cry at drop of a hat going, oh, my God, somebody just died 8 months ago and I'm crying now. You know what I'm trying to say? They don't understand what's happening to them. They don't understand that they're going through the seven stages of grief. And grief has no time limit. My girlfriend said this one time to me when my father passed. She goes, I said, I don't feel anything. She goes, you're not going to, not right now. But it could be 6 months, 8 months from now. You could be doing something. You could just be walking or playing something or setting up the show or something. And all of a sudden, you're just going to be crying and crying without any rhyme or reason. It's just going to overwhelm you. You're just going to bust out for no reason at all. I go, why is that? And she goes, I don't know, but it happens. And you know what? It could. It did. And it doesn't have a time. It doesn't have a time limit. It doesn't. Some people can grieve for 2 years, 3 years. And this woman here lost her husband 4 years ago. She's still grieving. She doesn't know what is happening to her. She doesn't understand the seven stages of grief. But if you have something that is telling you, this is going to happen next, or this is the next stage, and you may feel this. You may be able to control what you're feeling and manage it. Maybe not control, manage it. You know, if you know what's coming next, and is that something that, what am I feeling? Why am I angry? You know, why am I, you know what I'm trying to say? So this is what we try to do for the show. The acceptance does not equate to happiness. Even though you accept what's happening, it does not mean it's going to be happy. Rather, acceptance is the stage where a grieving person makes a conscious decision to move on and work towards a feeling normal again. After a significant loss, a person rarely feels the same way they were before again. Acceptance occurs when a person stops looking towards the past and focuses on the future. And on that note, what I wanted to do, oh, my God, we got a full-ass room here. 111, you live on the air. So what I want? Yes. 111, you live on the air. Hello. Okay.
That's probably Solution. He's waiting to make his grand entrance.
So who wants to volunteer? I know Sarge's been in the service and he never volunteers, but I got to know who wants to volunteer.
For what?
Volunteer for what? Pray tell.
Ah, there's a surprise. Who wants to volunteer?
Now, wait a minute.
All
I
can
volunteer is something I don't know nothing about. Did you not realize I was in the armed forces for 24 years? Are you crazy? What am I supposed to be volunteering for?
Come on.
Is it a dangerous mission from which I'm not likely to return alive?
No.
It could be.
Well, what is it? Just give me a hint. At least you know to give the option. Well, before you volunteer, you can kind of back. You don't have to volunteer, but just let you know if you do, you're not likely to come back alive.
You may not be the same.
All right, so what is it, Brian? Give me a hint. Was what I'll be volunteering for?
It's called a mind diagnostic test, meaning, are you depressed? It's a test to see if you are in a depression or not, and it's a mind diagnostic.
I get it.
Yeah.
Well, based upon your description of the seven phases of grief, seven stages of grief, then I have reached the acceptance stage long ago, and now the only thing I really think about with regard to losing my wife is that I'm grateful I had her. I'm grateful I had the opportunity to know her, know she was mine. So I'm at the acceptance stage right now, if I know that much.
Yeah, you're at seven. You're healthy. You're at seven. Melissa?
Yeah, I've recovered, I think.
No, thank you.
Okay. Okay, Sarge, thank you for volunteering. Here we go. Sarge, thinking about the past 2 weeks,
To what extent have you found the following things a problem? Here we go. Difficulty focusing on everyday tasks. Never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time. Do you have difficulty focusing on everyday tasks, Sarge? Never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time.
I'd say between never and some of the time.
Okay, here we go. Finding no joy in life or feeling like you will never again find joy. The answers are never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time. Finding no joy in life or feeling you'll never find joy again. Never, some of the time, most of the time.
I never feel that way. Never.
Okay. Being lethargic or having no energy. Never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time. Being lethargic or having no energy. Never,
I got lots of energy, so I'd say never.
Never, okay. Eating too much or too little. Never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time. Eating too much or too little.
Some of the time.
Okay. Being full of nervous energy or moving much less than usual. Never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time. Being full of energy, nervous energy, or moving much less than usual.
I don't have a lot. I got a lot of energy, but not nervous energy, so I don't know how to answer it.
than usual. I'm going to go never. Okay, oversleeping or struggling to get to sleep. Never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time.
I never oversleep. Never.
Okay, never. Okay, you're almost there. You're halfway there. Being harsh on yourself or overly self-critical. Never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time.
Between some of the time and most of the time. I'm always criticizing myself for something I could have done better.
Okay. Feeling low or under a cloud. Never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time.
Some of the time. But that's mainly due to looking out with dismay at the political situation. But beyond that, no, I don't have it.
Okay. Considering harming yourself or committing suicide. Never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time.
Never contemplate committing suicide.
We're almost there. Only three left. Headaches, cramps, aches, or pains that won't go away. Never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time.
I have lots of pains, but they go away usually because I've injured myself doing something strenuous.
Yeah.
But they go away.
But they do go away. Okay, so that's never.
Yeah.
Okay. Loss of interest or pleasure in things you previously found enjoyable. Never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time.
Well, some of the time, but not usually.
Okay. Last one. Feeling angry, irritable, or frustrated, even over small matters. Never. Some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time.
Some of the time.
Okay. And slow thinking, speaking, or body movements. Never, some of the time, most of the time, nearly all the time.
Sarge, really? Never.
Never.
Okay, never. Okay, last
slow
one.
Thinking.
Feeling that Republicans are off the rails all the time, never. No, forget it.
Is that a Brian added question?
Yeah, I just added.
I tell you what, you could go ahead and answer because I suspect you ain't going to be honest about it no matter what. So you just go ahead and answer for me.
Well, here we go. Your very low risk is 0 to 6. Very low.
I found it probably easy to reconcile things that are bad because I've been through a lot of bad experiences, so I had to figure out a way to do it. And I think I've made my peace with bad experiences, chalk them up to learning in a lot of cases. So, in other words, I developed kind of a coping mechanism that works good for me by keeping everything in perspective and realizing that the sun doesn't rise and set in my behind, basically.
Well, according to this, your results indicate that you may be experiencing symptoms of mild depression. When your symptoms are not likely having a major impact on your life, it is important to monitor them. Now, here we go.
Very low risk is from 0 to 6. Low risk is from 7 to 13. Moderate risk is from 14 to 20. High risk, meaning that you're suffering from suppression, is 21-27. Severe risk is 28-39.
Yeah.
You have scored stars. You have scored, congratulations, very low. Not very low. You are low risk. You're 7.
Well, I'm glad I didn't take the test 4 years ago because I probably would have gotten a high risk at that time.
Right.
I hadn't figured out how
right.
to straighten everything out yet.
Well, you
all
are
those
7.
Symptoms that you're describing, I had many of them except for the suicidal ideation, but beyond that, I had a lot of the other things.
Exactly. Well, here's a guy. Stay with me. Here's a guy right now, and he's this guy's about, I'm seeing the time. This guy's about maybe I'm looking at 22. This is how he overcame depression by just sitting around. This is Jonathan. Just listen to this guy for a minute. Give him a shot. It's only going to take 4 minutes. Here we go.
What did I do? Depression can get to anyone. It got me when I was a teenager. Now, it is incredibly difficult to explain depression to someone who's never experienced it before. Being depressed doesn't necessarily mean you want to take your own life. More often than not, it means you wouldn't mind if you just disappeared, never to return. But after trying and failing to explain this multiple times, I discovered it really all boils down into one sentence. I didn't want to die. I just didn't want to live. Now, I would get mad at myself because I felt like I had no reason to be sad or tired or depressed. I had an amazing childhood. I had great friends. I had a long-term girlfriend. I had good grades in school. And by good grades, I mean I knew exactly how much I had to study to get a solid 60% on the test. When I was just shy of 16 years old, I decided to tell a couple of friends I felt depressed. I don't know what I expected. I think I thought just telling them would make me feel better. It did not. I noticed that people don't always know how to show their support to someone suffering from depression. They want to show their support, but how? Well, let's talk about it. There are multiple ways to show your support to someone suffering from depression, four of which I will go into. Now, the first method is what I call the good life method. Now, when I told my friends about my depression, a lot of them would react along the same lines. They would say, but Jonathan, you have such a good life. You have so much to be happy for. Why are you not happy? Look at that guy. He has reasons to be unhappy, but he's not. So why are you? Now, this didn't work out all that well, because even though they had the best intentions, it would always come across as, why are you being such a crybaby? And this didn't help, especially because I was already mad at myself for feeling this way. Now, the second method is what I call the, oh, thanks, I'm cured now method. This is where someone will come up to me and say, you know, I was depressed once, and I just stopped thinking about it. And then I felt better. And that's what they would tell me to do. Now, these people almost always seem to forget that depression is an actual illness. So it would be like telling someone with the flu, have you tried, you know, not having the flu? Now, the third method is what I call the hear when you need to talk method. These are usually close friends who will want to know how you're doing nearly every waking minute of every day. And for a lot of people, this will help. A lot of people really do just need that constant outlet to vent to. Now, I don't like to talk about my emotions a lot. I listen to and make music as an outlet for these emotions. So I rarely feel the need to talk to other people. And this is where the fourth and last method comes in. I call this the just sit here with me method. Now, let me tell you about one of the most memorable moments of my life. I came home from school at about 1 in the afternoon because I rarely ever went to school for the full day. Sat about the house for 30 minutes, and a friend of mine rang me up. He said, "Jonathan, went to the park, we got music, we got snacks, we got a case of beer. Come hang out." With little hesitation, I decided to join them. And so we went to the park. And all we did was sit there, listen to music, and drink a couple of beers. Cheers. The conversation was pretty much non-existent for the greater part of the afternoon. And when there was an ongoing conversation, it was probably just incredibly shallow or incredibly funny. And that's the part that worked for me. Being surrounded by friends who didn't treat me any differently because of how I felt. They all knew about it. And they all thought it would be best not to talk about it. Because if I wanted to talk about it, I probably would have said something. In these cases, I was able to focus on the bad jokes my friends were telling me. And it was the first time that entire school year that I truly felt happy for a moment. Now, I don't do well on my own, but I thrive when I'm with friends. I've learned that if I have the option to go and see friends, I should always take it. It took a lot of time to start asking friends to hang out. It even took a lot of time to start accepting these invitations. But to me, that one day in the park was a turning point. I now knew my ability to feel happiness didn't disappear. But a lot of the times I need friends around me to trigger the emotion. And it's not about feeling truly happy all the time when you're with friends. It's more about being occupied. In these cases, my mind was able to focus on the stories my friends were telling me and intense calculations about how cold the coldest beer in the fridge should be by now. Now, I came across all of these methods when I was depressed. The just sit here with me method is the one that worked for me. I'm really glad I found that out. But there's one thing that worries me. And that's that the first two methods, the good life and the, oh, thanks, I'm cured now, method, are far more common than the last two. And this worries me because these methods did more harm than good. Because in the end, it wasn't the people who kept saying, "You'll be fine," that held me from my depression. It was the people who just showed up, sat next to me, and had a beer with me while watching sports. You know someone. Someone like me. Or someone else suffering from mental issues. Go knock on their door. Bring a six-pack, bring a slice of pizza, and either be the ear they need to vent to, or the person that would just sit there with them. Because sometimes your words may do more harm than good, but just your presence might go a long way.
Oops. I think I'm still on the air. I think I'm still here. You guys, can you hear me?
Yep.
Nope.
I hear you.
Can anybody? Okay.
Yep.
You know, what he said at the end, it was interesting. Sometimes words, when you try to mean well, I hated those words. You'll get over it. You'll be fine. I mean, when I hear those words, it's like you're dismissing what I'm going through or what anybody else is going through. And to be, and you don't know what people are going through.
You know, I hate it. I don't know if Melissa feels the same way. I don't know if you feel the same way, Sarge. Well, when somebody passes, they go, I know how you feel. No, you don't. Each individual feels differently. I hate that phrase, oh, I do know how you feel. I think it's like you're a pompous ass if you know how I feel. I used to hate that phrase, you know, I know how you feel. Because I don't know. Each individual has their own pain threshold or going through their own shit. How can anybody?
I couldn't agree with you more on that one, Brian. I don't know if it doesn't bother me quite as much as it does you, but I never say I know how you feel because I don't know how they feel. What I say is I'd like to offer you my condolences on the loss of whomever. I can do that.
Right.
I can offer you my condolences, but I have no idea as to how you feel. So for all I know, you might be happy they're gone. I don't know.
Exactly.
But I can offer you my condolences, and that's what I'm going to do. So I mean, I don't make such presumptions.
Yep. I get irritated for people I don't know on Facebook.
Oh,
you got my friend. Yeah, isn't the word? It's like, oh, you got. Mm-hmm. I don't even know you. Oh, well, we're going to pray. Shut up. I don't know what your relationship with God is. God should be pissed off at you and send you to hell. The only thing I need is you be my representation to God. But it's just a pompous attitude of we pray for you. You'll get through this. Or, oh, yeah, so-and-so had the same situation and they went through this. It's like, shut the fuck up.
Or they tell
shut
their
up.
Own 50-paragraph life story of what they've been through.
It's like, less is more. It's really, you know, so anyway, the reason I said somebody's
going to... I do think, though, to be fair, though, Brian, there's a certain basis for these pro forma statements that people always make, and that is there's a universal understanding of how grief affects people, and for the most part, it's pretty much true, and a lot of these, like I said, these pro forma, almost ritualistic things we say in the wake of someone's death are based on that understanding. So I can understand what people say, but it's still irritating me. I kind of share your sentiments about it in that respect. Because it is ritualistic and, like I said, pro forma and not even really thought about. I whenever I know someone and I have at least an inkling of who they are and what their person they lost meant to them, I try to individualize my response to them. It's a sign of respect that I understand you as an individual have lost someone that's individually important to you, and this is my understanding of how I should respond and acknowledge your grief. I try to.
Right.
I probably don't always succeed, but at least I keep that in my mind when I think how to craft my responses to them.
Exactly. The truth of the matter is it's very uncomfortable for everyone, you know? For everyone, it's really uncomfortable.
What I always have done is let the person know, if you need me, I'm there for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah,
that's
always valuable to hear. Yeah, that's always valuable to hear.
It's that simple. That's all you have to do.
Yep.
And if they reach out to you, then they do. If they don't, they don't.
And if you're able to, you know, you can check on them later to ask you if there's anything they'd like to talk about. I'm here to talk about it with you if you want to.
Yep. Absolutely.
What you just said and what I just said, I think is some of the most meaningful things you can do.
Yep.
Well,
it's
that
simple.
I'm not good at consoling someone. I know what I'm good at and what I'm not good at. And it's not to be mean. Some people are just are so uncomfortable that they just don't know what to say. I'm one of these people that I'll sit with you, and we don't have to say a word for 3 hours. You know what I mean? We don't have to say a word. We can have. I can relate to what a guy can have a beer or marshmallow. Watch basketball, whatever. Knowing that, and in fact, Melissa was saying they will come to you and give you the lead of how to respond. But it's,
all you have to do is talk about anything. It doesn't have to be, you know, you let them lead the conversation of what they want. If they want to talk about TV, right, or I don't know. No, no, you don't have to say certain things. Let them lead the conversation about what they want to talk about.
True. And it says here, and just in case you don't know what we're talking about, this is the time of year where somebody in the U.S. right now is going to have that Thanksgiving dinner for the first time without that person. This is the first time that person is going to miss Thanksgiving dinner because they're dead,
mm-hmm.
or maybe they separated or they divorced. This doesn't have to be death all the time. It could be divorce, separation, your best friend, you're no longer best friends, whatever. Grief is grief.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always have to be death. It could just be separation. And it's going to be hard. The holidays are going to be hard. It's going to be hard where people are smiling and shopping and you just lost the love of your life or whatever, and you're feeling like shit and you're seeing people smiling and laughing and then you get mean. Have you ever got me like, what are you laughing at? And you don't even want to see it, and you know life is going on and you're not realizing like it should stop for me for a moment. You know, can we just stop for a moment and breathe? But you look at life
but
is going on.
Yeah.
It doesn't. I know. Mm-hmm. And the dog still shits on the lawn and the people are still picking it up and people are still flipping each other, you know, mm-hmm. as they drive by, asshole. It's
still gone.
You know, it's funny. It was yeah. like Cindy laughed at me and I maintain this. There is a little cartoon that changed my life at 12, which is it was a boy named Charlie Brown. Then he still laughs at me. But the moral of the story of boy named Charlie exactly. But the moral of the story that I found out about it, because I had this thing about always being the best in my mind, second place is a loser kind of thing, and you perform the best, and I have. You know, really great. Great grades, athletic ability, good, you know, whatever. But one time I let my mother down. My mother she was never one of these people who whip you. She was always one of these people like, I'm really disappointed in you. That shit was the shit. You know, that's where you couldn't get, you rather them just kick you in the ass and, you know, go on and forgive you. But when they look at you and say, oh my God, that was death. So I was going through, I guess, a mild depression. I saw this movie, Boy Named Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown was the one. If you didn't see Boy Named Charlie Brown, you got to see Boy Named Charlie Brown. It's on right now. I think it's coming on in 2 days. But basically, he goes with the spelling bee, and first time in his life he's become.
It's the Christmas special that's coming.
Yeah, but you need to see it. It's the first time in his life he became a winner. I mean, he's doing the spelling bee. Then, and I'm going to do a spoiler alert for the cartoon. And then towards the end, he just had to spell this one word. If he spells this one word, he could finally erase the loser in him, and he could be the winner forever. And the word was Beagle, which was Snoopy. Snoopy is dog, you know. And so and so he fucks up the spelling of Beagle. Now, all through for 45 minutes, everybody goes, you can do it, Charlie Brown. You know, they're giving him parades and everything because he kept winning spelling bees. He was at the championship at this point. So as soon as he misspelled Beagle, everybody goes, are you kidding me? You blockhead. He became the loser. Everybody went home. He got on the bus by himself.
Poor Charlie.
He finally got home. There's nobody there to meet him. He put his head down, and he just went right into his room. He climbed under the covers and put the covers over his head. And you see Linus comes in, and Linus is telling him about school. And Charlie Brown says, I'll never go to school again. I don't want to do this. And Linus was saying, well, Charlie Brown, you know, Linus says, Charlie Brown, just because you missed the spelling means that we don't like you. You still got friends, Charlie Brown. I have no friends, blah, blah, blah. He went through this. I don't have friends. I'm not going to say anybody. He puts the covers over his head. Linus goes to the curtain, and he opens up the curtain. And he says, look out the window, Charlie Brown. And he looks out the window and goes, the leaves are still falling. The snow is still falling. You know, nothing has changed. Life has gone on. Nothing. What he's saying is the world did not stop because you made a mistake. And then Charlie Brown gets out of the bed, and then he sees Lucy with a little football. And she's not paying attention to him, and today he's going to kick that football. So he goes around, tries to kick the football. She pulls it away and says, welcome home, Charlie Brown. nothing changed. So no matter what you're going through, and I get the moral of that cartoon is that, you know, you think the world ended or you think the world ends. Something's going through your life and you think the world is ending. But the world does not end, like Melissa says. It keeps going. Nothing changes. People still are doing the same thing. So the world did not end. So if you get a chance to see it, it's a good tool to see with the kids, and that's how I got out of it. I like that. Today is Monday.
That was my first lunchbox when I started school. It was a back in the day. They were metal, and it had all the peanuts on it.
They were metal.
Yeah, and it had probably the peanuts on it. Those things are worth some money now.
Those big thermoses. Remember those big thermoses in the lunch?
Yep. And you could put soup.
No, the worst that you did, I could not. It's milk. And that was the worst thing. It's like, okay, in the morning it's cold, but I don't eat till 12. So that's been in my locker for about 4 hours of room temperature. So when you finally get it in this. So my first lunchbox was the Beatles. I had first lunchbox. I had the Beatles on mine. Yes. That was my first lunchbox. I remember my – it was tragic. I was carrying this lunchbox like an idiot. And I'm looking around, and people have lunchboxes, and I'm looking around going, no. I want the paper bag. Give me the wino bag. God. I used to call it the wino bag because the wino used to drink the booze out of the bag. I wanted the wino bag. And I started carrying my lunch on my paper bag. That was cool.
Beat off a perpetrator with one of those metal lunchboxes. Seriously, damage one of those things.
Well, we'll be. Well, you know what? It's 2 minutes. I want to thank Sarge for coming in the studio today. I know Mr. Solution is in here.
Despite your best efforts to make sure I wouldn't know what time I'm supposed to be here.
That's not true. I'm not having problems.
I want to Sarge. Join Brian's Facebook.
I'm afraid I might have to just give in and do that because I can't count on him.
He'll know. No, I think today was a Blog Talk issue, big time.
It was Blog Talk. Yeah, it was Blog Talk. I'm on my cell phone right now because my landline's not working. But I just want to say thank you, Sarge. I know Solution is here. Thank you, Solution, for coming in. Of course, the lovely Melissa who kept this show going today. Thank you so much for all your hard work.
You're welcome.
Stanley, thank you for coming in.
Stanley.
And we got four other people on 111s who are not talking. But the ratings are going higher in this show. It is really higher. I'm looking at the thing. I'm going, whoa, you guys really miss me. You guys really miss me.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, I'm glad to see that we had this marvelous existential discussion today. For your next show, can we count on our usual serving of degeneracy and decadence?
We'll talk about Donald Trump tomorrow.
No, that's not decadence, man. That's politics. I mean, I'm talking about the usual degeneracy and decadence that you're known and loved for.
Oh, sexy.
And that is what? Give me a subject.
Oh, please. I don't even want to get started, man. Look, why don't you go back and listen to some of your shows, okay? If you don't know, I can't describe it any better than you can yourself.
Trigger.
You got to admit, Mike.
Sexually triggered.
You got to admit my title. I know, but you got to admit my titles are pretty eye-catching. Come on. The titles of my shows, come on. You got it.
Yeah, I expect you to do your own version of Wet Ass Pussy any day now.
Oh, my God.
Our relationship show, Wet Ass Pussy, or the relationship show.
No wonder I go in my bedroom and listen to this show.
You said bedroom and you go in. Melissa.
I triggered him.
Yeah, that's triggered. I know it triggered me. I know it's going to trigger him.
There it goes. It's triggered.
All right, so when are you going to be not be on next time, Brian?
I will be on tomorrow. I'll be up until I'll be up until Wednesday. Thursday, Thanksgiving, of course.
Of course.
Friday, I would be.
But I'm
Friday,
talking about now.
Be,
what time Pacific Coast time are you going to start the show?
7:30 a.m. is safe.
Okay. All right. We'll see about that. But I made a note.
Okay.
We'll see.
And I'm gonna play. I'm gonna play "Suicide Is Painless" only because this.
Yeah, I know.
I got in trouble last time. People screamed at me. I like the song. The truth of the matter is, we got to be mindful and really focus on what real life is. And real life is 1 out of 4 people think about suicide, if not more. It's that's the ugly part of life that is true. And especially this day and holidays, it's even probably higher than that. From kids to teenagers to senior citizens going into, we're not even talking about senior citizens. You know one subject I guarantee you, Oprah never talked about it. Dr. Phil never talked about it. Nobody talked about it because they're afraid to talk about it. Why do people make the decision to go to hospice? Nobody has talked about that at all.
That what?
Think about it.
That what?
Why do elderly people or people make a decision to go to get hospice care?
Because it's called it's actually called palliative care.
Okay.
And I've done it for people before. And I think that it's an amazing thing that you can give a person at the end of their life.
Well, nobody has, not that I have known, that anybody really talked about what kind of care that and what care that they are enduring that they're and can they change their mind once they commit to it. There's a lot of
usually your physical diagnosis at that point is that you are at the end of life and it's to make somebody the most comfortable that they can be.
It's not the same thing as euthanasia, Brian. But I get your point. I get your point. I mean, I want to make it clear. I have thought about suicide, but only in the sense of rejecting it. Because I believe remember the guy in Jurassic Park? I forget his name. Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah,
remember the kid's character made this statement, life will always find a way. Well, you got to have life to find a way. So.
Yeah.
Suicide simply is not the way because it's death and it ends everything physical. So you got to have life to find a way. So I think if you think about suicide, that's understandable. But in the end, in just about every instance, except maybe a situation like Masada, you ought to reject it.
Well, we're saying I toyed with that for years. But it's like the elephant in the room, and we're not talking about the GOP elephant. That's another elephant. But
don't
we are
do it.
Talking
that's
about.
To make you want to commit suicide? The Republican Party? Hell, they're putting the country on the road to suicide.
Well, you know what? Some people think that we're on our way to Armageddon. I mean, it's a real thought too, and that's why we have cults and all that. But we haven't really talked about. But seriously. No one has talked about, and it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing to say my grandmother just went into hospice and I agree with it. And then you can say, and the family members, how can you agree to this? We don't really understand, and Melissa just said it, we don't understand what that kind of care is. Nobody talks about that kind of care. And when does one think about that? And how is that different than suicide? Or the person who says do not.
Oh, no, it's not the same thing. So not by any stretch of the imagination.
No, it's not. Not at all.
Well,
no,
I don't know.
It's end of life care. Euthanasia is one that. Now, if they're giving people enough dope to make them comfortable so they die of, you know, a drug overdose, well, yeah, that is euthanasia. But I'm talking about just making them comfortable until they go by the whatever natural means or whatever means the maker has in store for them at the end of their lives. It's just not the same thing.
Well, the only reason I can say it is when denying treatment, or some people are just denying treatment or don't want treatment and rather take this there's some people who just don't deny treatment. But I'm just saying, it hasn't been, I mean, we're talking about it now.
But I'm just saying that people don't, and we could debate it when we talk about it, but I'm just saying these are such, see, I want to do a show to make people think, or I want to do a show that something is happening right now. Right now, as we're speaking, somebody's just been admitted to hospice. Right now, some family is pissed off and saying, why did you do this? Or some daughter is screaming,
it doesn't,
how
no,
did she
you're,
make
you're,
this?
You're reading this incorrectly.
Okay.
My father was 80 and he passed away last August. And when I got a phone call saying that he was going into hospice for palliative care, I knew. And he was only there for 4 days, which was good. Right? It was end of the life. It's a decision that's made. And it was good. You have care for you. It's almost a, how do you describe it? You make sure that the person has dignity and care, whether it be being clean, talked to, holding their hand. It's a brushing their hair.
Now there's only one caveat I'd like to add to this, though, Melissa.
Yep.
I think
it's
better if the family can do that. I think it's better if the family's able to do hospice. That's the best thing.
Uh-huh. Some people do.
You know, I grant you that hospice is a decent alternative if that's not possible.
Yeah. I remember going to see my grandmother at the end of her life in hospice, and I still did the same thing that I had done for people before. I put lotion on her. I fixed her hair. I made sure she was clean. I talked to her, even though she wasn't really awake.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very personal thing to do for somebody.
Yeah.
It to give them that, the end of the life. And I think it's so that they don't have any fear, right?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I know what you mean, because for the last year of her life before my wife died, they sent my mother from Chicago down here to live with me. She stayed with me about 10 months.
Yeah.
But she said she wanted to go back to Chicago to die there. And so, it was actually a privilege for me to be able to take care of my mother and do the things for her that she did for me when I was young and growing up.
Yep, and that's
one of the things I am most grateful for in her dying is that I was actually able to care for my mother the way she cared for me, and I will always have that as a treasured memory.
You're exactly right. That's how I felt about my grandmother, but that's how I felt about other people that were strangers to me that I did that for.
Yeah.
It is
a profound thing to take care of a loved one in the last moments of their life and know
it
that
is.
You're able to put, and bring them some measure of comfort. Because, you know, I'd set up things in a room, so I'd set up a flat screen TV and a DVR and everything else so we could watch movies together. We both enjoyed watching movies, and I'd get her the things she needed. I'd have to clean her up regularly and all this stuff, but that was okay. All of it was good because I was helping myself. I'm doing what you did for me, Mom, and I'm so grateful I'm able to
do
it. I'm able to do
it. It's a privilege.
It is.
Absolutely.
It is. It helped me watching her go helped me to accept her death, because it wasn't like, I didn't grieve as much as I thought I would, because I accepted it as an inevitability, and I knew I had a great deal to do with making it easier for her.
Yeah.
So it really was helpful to me to care for her, and I had the acceptance of her death even before she was dead. I was at that stage.
Yeah.
I think it was a great thing.
It is.
I think it was really a great thing.
When you're at the end of your parents' lives, they didn't have hospice involved, Brian?
Yeah, my father
didn't
have it. My sister took care of him. In his last days, my sister was sick. So our family actually performed pretty much the hospice function for our close loved ones, and we're glad that we did.
Yep.
Well, the closest
it was the
thing
same
came
thing,
down
Brian.
To...
It was pretty much the same thing, except we couldn't prescribe drugs. That was about it.
Yeah.
Well,
but we had
the
doctors
closest,
who did that, so that was okay too.
They use a pump. that goes into somebody's tummy. Yeah, I hear you.
You guys hear me? Oh, okay. Uh-huh. Well, the closest thing we had was the DNR, do not resuscitate kind of thing. That's a whole different story. It's a big horror story that happened at my house when
Still not euthanasia either.
I understand. But according to the Catholic Exchange, tomorrow's subject will be hospice horrors. Shit that happened.
Oh, well, look, you're talking about things that are illegal. Now you're talking about criminal activity or violations
of regulation.
These are hospice horrors. I'm assuming these are hospice horrors. These are things that are preventable and or prescribed by law.
Meaning that they're not getting proper care, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's got to be illegal or civil violations, at least.
Well,
disgusting care.
Yeah. Say nothing of immoral, but I'm certain that such activity is illegal.
Well, you know, I don't know. If you put somebody, you know, if you're not being visited, people, let's just face it, nobody wants to go to a nursing home.
Oh, well, you mean neglect by the family.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff.
That's a whole different thing than the people who are responsible. Look, people at hospice can't make you come visit your relatives. They're obligated to do things they are to care for their patients. That's what they're obligated to do. The question is, do they do that? Do they do at least the minimum that the state and or whoever regulates them expects them to do?
Right.
The question.
Well, we'll talk. We're not going to stay on it long. We're not going to stay on it long. But hospice is part of life. And you guys want to hear this? The 35 creepy last words when a patient is dying. Come on, we end it. We always have to end the show on something weird.
Absurd.
These are the
35.
Absurd.
Yeah.
Absurd. Exactly. That's what makes our show special. 35 creepy last words uttered by patients before dying, as shared by doctors and nurses. These are 35 creepy last words uttered by patients. I'm not going to go all 35. Let's see. Working in healthcare will teach you that death is inevitable. You'll be one of the few people to know how life starts and how it will end. Here's a compilation of the responses. It says here, number one, but I don't know how to get there. Grandpa in hospice. Haven't spoken in days. He died about 2 hours later. Creepy words. Not a doctor, but I overheard an old lady whisper this to her old husband dying of kidney problems. You're going to beat this. You got away with murder. This is nothing. You got away with murder. This is nothing.
If you remember back to a certain well-advertised product, how about this one? I could have had a V8.
Oh,
you remember that one?
I heard that one. See, that could be funny. Here's one. I work in a cardiac ICU. We had patients who had a pulmonary artery rupture, a rare but known complication of a Swan-Ganz catheter. Okay, I don't know what's funny about that, but, okay. 1 minute he was joking around with us, and the next bright red blood was spewing out of his mouth. His last words before he died were, "Why is this happening to me? It still haunts me years later." Wow. Wow. Number four, I am enthralled with this. I can't get it. I want to read this. Number four, a nurse here. She had a patient come into the ER with shortness of breath. He started deteriorating in the ER and then quite rapidly on the transport to the ICU. We got him wheeled into his room. We placed the ER lines and tubes with our own and transferred him from the transport stretcher to the ICU bed. He actually did most of the transfer himself. He didn't say anything. But just before he died, he pleasantly adjusted his own pillow, laid his head down,
and then his eyes went blank. This man just made himself comfortable before lying down to die. Ooh, isn't that freaky? I'm a nurse and was previously working as an assistant living community on the dementia Alzheimer's unit. This is the last one. My very favorite patient had been declining pretty steadily, so I was checking on him frequently. We would have long chats and joke around with each other, but in the last 2 weeks of his life, he stopped talking completely and didn't really acknowledge conversation or direct it at him at all. I finished my medication rounds for the evening and went to see him before I left. I told him I was leaving for the night and that I'll see him the following day. And he looked at me in the eyes and smiled so genuinely and said, "You look like an angel." I thought it was so sweet because he had not seen lucid. He didn't seem lucid in weeks. He died the next morning. It really messed with me. These are nurses who are having these stories, and these are the creepy things that people said to them before they died. Is that weird? Can you imagine? We didn't talk about that. Can you imagine? These are the people who are seeing death all around you every day. How can you see your favorite patient die, or you're seeing death all around each day, or you're with people who are miserable in hospital? Then you go home because you're a nurse, and you making turkey, and you're blessed. How can you believe in God if you're a nurse?
You know what he's had? Put together for a treat.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, can you hear us?
I can barely hear, huh?
I can hear you now. UPS,
oh, okay.
Here. He's my second boyfriend. No, he's not as cute as that last guy. He was my favorite.
Who are you talking about?
UPS guy.
Oh.
We used to have a little short guy with dark hair, and boy, he's a swagger. He'd get off of that truck and he'd swagger his way right to the door. Yeah. Oh, he loves you.
All right, guys. We're out of here. But those are creepy things that nurses see every freaking day. Doctors, you wonder, doctors do their thing and they go away. But nurses are there for their care from the beginning to the end. The doctors, they just do their surgery going, "I'm out of here. See you later."
Yeah. Nurses are the backbone of healthcare.
And can you imagine how depressed they could be seeing death every day and then they go home to their families? Wow.
It's a part of life. It's part of life.
I don't know if it
is.
I decided not to go. I'm not going.
Yeah, but, you know, think about it. If we lived to be really old, would we have quality of life?
No.
Nope. You live to be 100, right? Or 100, let's say 150. And you can't even go to the bathroom by yourself, and you can't do anything great anymore.
I have a rule. As soon as my heart on disappear, I do too. Done.
All right.
I live by the sword, and I die by the sword. I live by the sword, and I die by the sword.
By the sword. Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah.
Good night.
That's crazy. Yeah. Men are so stupid about their dinks.
Hey. Give some respect to the dick. See, that's the problem. You have no respect for the penis.
What about?
Hey, listen. All you have to do is look at your beautiful daughter and your great-grandchildren. Guess who brought them into the world? That's right. The penis.
No, the vajayjay did.
Yeah, the vajayjay did. It helped. It was there. I mean, it was like the pot for the meal.
Yeah,
but without the sugar and spice and the recipes and the rub, it's no meal.
So even Sarge hung up on this.
You guys are the oven that has to make sure that it's cooked well. It's a slow cooker while we put in the rub, the spices, the little personalities, the stuff.
Oh, my God.
And you guys cook it.
How self-important you are.
You know I'm lying. I know.
I know.
Have a great day, everybody.
That women are just an incubator.
Huh?
Some men do think that women are just an incubator.
Well, some women are sperm deposit units.
I welcome them to try it.
Melissa.
Okay, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
No distraction around here. Get out of here.
See you guys tomorrow.
That suicide is painless. Oh my God. This is bad. I got one plate of the guy who died.
I can take or leave it if I please.
You know this.
I do.
The game of
it's
life
terrible.
Is hard to play.
Shut it off.
Suicide is painless. It brings on many changes, and I can take or leave it if I please. Doesn't hurt when it begins, but as it works its way on in, the pain grows stronger, watch it breathe.